And let's see, Carla is on board, right? I see Keelan. There's Carla. Who's legal counsel?
Lori Kraut.
Lori. Excellent. She doesn't join us very often, does she? All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is the May 20th, 2020 morning session of the Portland City Council. Good morning, Carla. If you could please call the roll.
Good morning, Mayor. Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the council are attending remotely by phone, and the city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote social distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. First up, Carla's communications. If you could please call the first individual.
Did you want to have Lori read the rules?
Oh yeah, I forgot about the rules, sure.
That's okay.
You wouldn't mind reading the rules of order and decorum?
Certainly. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the city council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct, such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interfering or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded.
Thanks, Lori. Appreciate it. Carla, if you could please read, it looks like we only have one item for communications today.
Correct. Item 375, request of Donna Cohen to address council regarding St. John's Truck Strategy Phase 2 project.
Good morning, Donna.
Morning. I hope everybody's well. And thanks to the staff who did a great job setting me up for this morning. So in March, four people who had been members of the stakeholder committee from the community sent a report to PBOT and to council about an update on the project. And it's been 2 months, and I want to give you a status report on that. So if we look at the slides, the first slide, Keenan said I should tell you when to show the first slide. So I'm gonna wait
just
for that.
I'm pulling it up.
Okay. And I'm from St. John's, Donna Cohen again. I didn't say that at the beginning, so.
There it is.
Okay, so these are our speed cushions. A picture, as I say, is worth a thousand words. The one at the bottom is from North Willis, and every speed cushion I've seen in the city, except those that are in Fessenden, St. Louis, look like the one at the bottom. I don't know what went wrong here, But this is the second time they've been put down. These obviously need to be corrected. So, and why it happened in the first place, I don't know. Can we go to the next slide, please? So our median islands, now on the right side, I'm hoping you can see the full slide. On the right side, there should be a diagram from our final report showing the specs, which are 14 feet for the island itself, 16 feet if you add in the 1 foot on either side where the lane marking would be. And if you look in the drawing on the left side of the screen, there's an island that was done on Columbia Boulevard at about the same time. And you can see the clearance between the island and the line. And then if you look at the pictures in the middle, these are representative of almost every corner on every island that has been put on Fessenden St. Louis, where the lane markings, if they exist at all, peter out before the end. And people have said, you know, these corners are very sharp to begin with, and then you don't have the lane markings, and you can see already some of them have been driven into. So the blue marks show where the lane marking should be. Again, why this happened? I have to wonder, does Peabot even bother to go out and look at the work that's done before they pay the contractors? So these need to be done according to spec. They're just, anyways. Lastly, next slide, please. A commentary on this. We were told in the upper left, this is from the final report, that we would have these markings on the in the bike lanes, reminding people, the bicyclists, to stop for peds. The reason we wanted them is we have this this route, and you can see in the map, bisects our community of 15,000 people. 40% of the people above the corridor are kids, seniors, and people with disabilities. Vulnerable people, and now Peabot is saying that they don't want to do this, we don't have enough bicyclists. The fact is, this whole project is to change this corridor, which again runs through the center of St. John's. So we think this is a backward-looking approach. And by the way, the total cost to paint all of these markings would be between $5,000 and $10,000. And this is a multi-million dollar project. So I'm not going to go over the last slide, although I encourage you to look at it. It has some support information about accidents with bicyclists and what happens when a senior breaks a hip. And the So you can see that you know the damage to a senior or a child can be great. So we think it's a small insurance policy, basically. But so that we were told we weren't going to get. We would like to ask about that and just point out this information. But right. Thank you.
Can I ask you to bring it to a conclusion?
Yes, absolutely. And I was there. You wanted to ask something?
Oh, no.
Oh, you wanted to ask me to bring it to a conclusion. Yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I get it. Okay, well, I am at a conclusion. We hope that you folks will take steps and get these corrected. So
great. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming in. And thank you, by the way, for providing the written presentation. That makes a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good. That completes communications. Carl, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
All right, have any items been pulled off of the consent agenda?
We've had no requests.
Please call the roll on the consent agenda.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The consent agenda is adopted. Could you go to first time, sir? Oh, unfortunately, hang on. We're ahead of schedule. One moment. Find us. Can you go to 382, please?
Yes, 382. Authorize a contract with Landis and Landis Construction LLC for the construction of the Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard Pipe Reconstruction Project, number E10369, for an estimated cost of $2,900,000.
And colleagues, I'm obviously stalling till we can get to the appropriate time certain. This is a second reading. We've already heard a presentation and the opportunity for public testimony on this item. Is there any further business related to item 382? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
I want to say how much I appreciate the work of the staff on this project and the innovative, creative thinking about moving this project up due to clearly less traffic on Hawthorne nowadays. I look forward to the conclusion of this project. I vote aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. And
just trying to help you out, Mayor. It's trying to slow down.
Why don't we do this? Do we have everybody we need for 383 from the Housing Bureau? Do we have Marilyn? Yeah, we have Dory. And Dory, is there anyone else you need for that presentation? Or do we have everybody we need for that presentation for
383? It will just be me.
Okay, good. Carla, please read 383.
Approve and terminate limited tax exemptions for properties under the Homebuyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption Program.
Very good. Thank you. Colleague Portland, the Portland Housing Bureau, of course, administers the city's tax exemption programs, the Homebuyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption Program, otherwise more commonly known as the HOLTE program, provides a 10-year property tax exemption for low to moderate income homebuyers, making home ownership more obtainable for families in Portland. Home builders apply for the tax exemption prior to starting the construction on the new homes. The Housing Bureau approves builder applications through filing a resolution with City Council several times throughout the year. 39 properties are being approved for the program through this particular resolution. When a developer sells a home over the price limit, or to a buyer who does not income qualify, or when a home is not owner-occupied during the exemption period as required, the exemption is then removed. Before an exemption is terminated, owners have the opportunity to appeal decisions made by the city. Within this resolution, 14 properties tax exemptions are being removed, and we have Dory Van Bockel here, who is the Portland Housing Bureau Development Incentives Program Manager, who will be here to answer any questions we may have. Dory.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. This is Dory Van Bockel, and as the Mayor stated about the program, PHB administers this on behalf of the city, and we verify and confirm homebuyer eligibility with each sale. We do ongoing compliance of owner occupancy of the programs through regular auditing, and we work with the Multnomah County consistently to do that compliance. Certainly, I'm happy to answer any further questions about this action.
Colleagues, any questions for Dory? Carla, is there any public testimony on item 383?
No one signed up.
Very good. Call the roll on the resolution, please.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
This is a great program, and Dory Van Brockel and the team at the Housing Bureau do a great job of administering it. Aye.
Wheeler.
I vote aye. Thank you. Thanks, Dory. Appreciate it. The resolution is adopted. Back to time certain item 376, please, Carla.
Accept the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission 2019 State of the City Preservation Report.
Colleagues, it's a pleasure to introduce Kristen Miner, who's the chair of the Historic Landmarks Commission, who's going to present the Commission's 2019 State of Preservation Report. We also have other members of the Landmarks Commission joining us today. For those who are watching, you may not be familiar, the Historic Landmarks Commission is a 7-member, completely volunteer commission that advises city bureaus and the city council on matters related to historic preservation and reviews new development in historic districts and alterations which potentially affect historic landmarks. The commission typically meets twice a month for several hours at a time, and we appreciate their service and dedication to preserving the city's historic resources. Again, this is a huge time commitment, and it is done completely by volunteers. As the commission's report notes, preservation can be an important tool to aid our efforts for ensuring housing affordability and addressing climate change. As was recognized in the report, the practice of preservation has not always represented the larger community, and we look forward to hearing more about how this commission intends to help us expand our scope for a more complete picture of Portland and its history. For instance, on April 27th, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability submitted final drafts of the African American Historic Resources Multiple Property Submission, including a National Register Landmark nomination for the Billy Webb Elks Lodge to the National Park Service. Of Portland's more than 600 National Register Landmark properties, only three have been listed for African American heritage. Recognizing the histories of all Portlanders is a critical goal for our historic preservation program, one I strongly support, and I look forward to celebrating the Park Service's recognition of Portland's important Black history later this summer. Also, an individual National Register Landmark nomination has been submitted to recognize Portland's Darcel Showplace. According to the nomination, quote, "Darcel is truly a cultural ambassador, offering not only an opportunity for an evening's lighthearted fun, but underpinning that entertainment value to and that entertainment value to become known as a tireless supporter, therapist, drag promoter, and philanthropist for the LGBTQ community in Oregon and the West Coast. The Showplace is nationally significant for its role in the overall cultural shift towards societal acceptance of drag and gay rights. Good work, Kristen Miner, helping honor Darcel as the national pioneer we know Darcel is. Thank you for that. In addition, building rehabilitation has been proven to create jobs and keep dollars in the local economy. Even though it didn't pass, I'm proud that the Office of Government Relations advocated for a state rehabilitation tax credit during the 2019 legislative session. 35 other states have state rehabilitation tax credit programs to support seismic upgrades, ADA accessibility, and energy improvements to historic buildings. I look forward to Oregon joining their ranks in the very near future, but this won't happen without a coordinated, timed, and unified strategy. And of course, the entire Portland City Council stands in support of this action. Now let's hear from the commission. I'll turn this over to Kristen Miner. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor, and thank you so much for your introduction. I think you have already started with some of my talking points, but that's totally fine. Before I launch into my PowerPoint, I do want to acknowledge my fellow commissioners. And if that's okay, I'm going to go ahead and name them out. And I would ask all the commissioners to make sure you have your face showing and your screen on. So I'll start with Vice Chair Maya Fody. Maybe just wave. There you are, Maya. And then Matthew Roman. Good morning, Matthew. Annie Mahoney. There, great. Ernestina Fuenmayor. Good morning. Andrew Smith.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Derek Spears.
Morning,
excellent. And there is a little bit about all of our backgrounds in the State of the City that report that we submitted months ago. Feels like years ago now. I also want to acknowledge, before I start the PowerPoint, the BDS land use staff. They're so invaluable. They really help us through every single case. We could not do our job without them, especially Hillary Adam, who literally holds our hands and prepares us for everything. Cara Fioravanti, who is the supervisor of the Design and Historic Design Review, and then Brandon Spencer-Hartle, who's the liaison from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. He has an ability to see the big picture and puts in so much work to help us. So now I will see if I can share my screen. Great. Okay. My presentation today is necessarily just a little bit different than the State of the City report that we provided. We still have the same overall goals, but we definitely won't be seeking any funds from City Council this year, even for ongoing survey and historic resource inventory work. And we hope that can maybe resume next year. Instead, we hope to show you why preservation itself can help us get past the economic pain of this economic slowdown and address other long-term goals. The images selected here on this slide are all important long-standing cultural institutions. Some are businesses, some are nonprofits. And I'm sure that I could have chosen, you know, spent time and really ranked them, but this is just top of my head here. And in each of their ways, these places hold community together. So really what I'm trying to get at is the concept that preservation is not just about buildings, it's also about giving communities a voice in identifying what's important and hopefully saving community institutions and businesses. Our newest commissioner, Derek Spears, has researched a program used in a few other cities called Legacy Businesses, something that we would love to look into for Portland. As you pointed out already, Mayor Wheeler, we are volunteers. We have a very broad range of duties and expectations. So first, we review new construction in context. We tend to be made up of at least half architectural professionals. We review legislative code projects that affect development regulations. And development regulations are generally what we think of as the Portland Zoning Code or Title 33. And examples of that, I'm sorry for all the acronyms, but Historic Resources Code Project, the design overlay zone amendments, and residential infill project. We review alterations to historic individual buildings. We review and provide recommendations on historic designations of all types, type 4 demolition requests, guidelines for historic districts, and numerous briefings about city-owned resources. And we advocate for preservation to and with the larger community, all trying to achieve the goals in the plan. And finally, we're a resource for city council and bureaus. So in short, we dedicate time and energy to this work, not just because it's part of the comp plan, but because we see preservation as a strategy for helping to meet larger goals. And I'm gonna talk a little bit more about those goals here in this presentation. So I'm going to start here with a few wins. And Mayor Wheeler, actually, I already mentioned these, but I can't tell you how excited I am. It feels like a big shift to be able to highlight a few recent property designations that are tied to minority groups rather than to the most privileged Portlanders. So first off, the multiple property designation of African American resources. And thanks so much to Kathy Galbraith and the Architectural Heritage Center for much of this work. It really identifies many spheres of African American life and culture under which buildings or places might be individually recognized or designated. And then next, Darcel 15, it's a gay-owned drag club that has been around since before Stonewall happened in New York. And this might put it in line to have national significance in the area of LGBTQ history. And then finally, the Billy Webb Elks Lodge, known as at one time as the Black YWCA. This is the first historic designation directly under the African American MPD or multiple property designation. So we're definitely hoping to see more places important in Black history in Portland be protected. So I'm going to cover the three major themes that are highlighted in our report. So first, under equity, I chose this image of Chinese students arriving here in the 1940s or 50s because it is Asian and Pacific Islander month. We need to focus much more on preserving the places and history significant to minorities rather than the most beautiful mansions and the lives of wealthy white people. These typically are more modest places, but they're the most vulnerable to demolition. And as the pandemic shows us, people are still being discriminated against specifically for their ethnicity or color of their skin. Next, I want to address affordability. So even without any formal historic designation or tax credits or benefits that come with that, the oldest houses and apartments are already more affordable than anything recently built. That brings us to sustainability. These two images side by side are windows, but one of these windows will probably last all of 15 years. On the left, vinyl window, it's made from petroleum products, which is pretty much the least sustainable thing we can use. They also can't be fixed, so when they start to leak or degrade, they're pretty much trash. The other window was constructed over 100 years ago and can last another potentially 100 with maintenance. Maintenance saves durable materials, creates jobs, and most importantly, keeps all of that embodied energy and carbon that was used in its materials, production, and transportation costs. So much of the green building movement focuses on the annual energy use of a building, but the energy consumed in the construction of a building or a window is 15 to 30 times the annual energy use. So think of windows as an analogy to an entire building. We all should be reusing things that were made to last, not throwing them away. So a little bit more of a deep dive into each of these topics. This is kind of an interesting comparison. So if you would, please focus in on some of the changes in this area of close-in Central City, otherwise known as Lower Albina at one time. And let's see, I don't know if you can see, no, okay. I don't have the ability to use a pointer, but I think everyone can really look between the top and bottom slide and see the difference where I-5 occurred, you know, down sort of down the middle of the slide. If we zoomed out a little bit more, we could see the Memorial Coliseum. So in the lower slide, you can see the two parking structures and then just cut off in the image is the rest of the Coliseum, and then below that, the Rose Quarter. All of that was once, you know, that very fine grain residential and businesses that you see in the upper slide. And then just cut off in the slide also to the north is the Emmanuel Hospital area. So what was once a thriving community of people of color was demolished. But there's another thing I'd like to point out, given that this is Central City. And that's the sheer number of lots that were cleared that have never been developed. They are literally vacant or surface parking lots. And if you look in that lower image between the Broadway and Widener corridors there, again, Central City, this is what we got. Our elected officials handed out these lots when they were cleared to private interests. So we should be pushing for new housing here, both to recoup our investment in light rail and streetcar, and also to begin to heal the scars of what happened here. Of course, equity is not just an issue in Lower Albina. Preservation has a lot of catch up to do across Portland to advocate for the designation and rehabilitation of remaining places important to non-white or minority communities. These stories are part of our story. Historic designation does have benefits and incentives that should be accessible to all. And the Landmarks Commission is committed to trying to make this happen. affordability. The nation, state, and our city are about to be hit with a tidal wave of need generated by the pandemic, but it is worth remembering that historic preservation projects can literally put people back to work in strategic ways. Rehabilitation projects put more people to work than the construction of new buildings, even though the scale of each contractor's work tends to be smaller. The money earned is also much more likely to stay local. So the idea that we need to invest in better insulation, upgraded energy systems, and seismic stability is just as important now as it was before the pandemic, but now might turn out to be the best time to encourage this work with people that, I mean, that is small business right here in Multnomah County needing work. Designating, protecting, and fixing up older buildings allows for access to federal tax credits for renovation work. So that money can be coming from out of our area. The commission advocates for other ways to link financial and regulatory incentives aimed at the rehabilitation, seismic upgrade, and adaptive reuse of our historic and older buildings. Priorities include a state rehabilitation tax credit, which I hope we have another chance to think about, supporting changes in the Historic Resources Code project, and local preservation programs that support the adaptive reuse of old buildings with energy retrofit grants, easements, fee waivers, and other construction incentives. The best way to limit displacement, after all, is to keep people in their neighborhoods and give them a source of rental income. Finally, sustainability. We can't let this virus crisis or the ongoing housing crisis tempt us into giving up on our incredibly pressing climate problem. With the will to do it, we can push for reuse of buildings, incentivizing developers to remodel, upgrade, and add on to existing buildings. Raising older buildings results in a big hit on scarce resources. First, we're throwing away millions of dollars of embodied energy. And that's represented in that uppermost slide. The second image is a new house up on North Wygant. It cost well over $1 million. And of course, it's zero energy certified. It has solar on the roof, very high-end finishes. But the problem is its new materials alone put it deep in the red in terms of its carbon footprint. So aside from how it looks and how large it is, studies show that the embodied energy savings increase dramatically as a building life stretches over 50 years. So we can't build our way out of the climate crisis, even with energy intensive new buildings. The American Institute of Architects has called for a dramatic uptick in adaptive reuse projects. This is real. This is a real crisis. April just set the record as the hottest April on the planet ever. So the construction industry must change, and it must do so quickly. We need leadership to make this happen. The last image is one of the simplest ways we as a city can move to embrace adaptive reuse projects and encourage more density in single-family areas. I did say this isn't the year to ask for money, and we won't, but we do still seek your support and leadership to help us do an effective job in all the decision-making and advocacy that we do. I want to touch on historic districts and why they're important. Historic districts should visually convey a story, that is, a reason why the properties are important, and not just the individual buildings. This is important for your understanding of, say, the Japantown Chinatown Historic District, shown on the left. This is Portland's only historic district important for preserving the history of an ethnic and cultural immigrant community. If a district, any district, starts to lose the sense of visual coherency, the district starts to feel just like anywhere else in Portland, with new tall buildings interspersed with older, smaller ones. the more disparity between the existing scale of the fabric and the Central City Plan allowances, the more conflicts there will be in land use cases, cases that will almost certainly come to you as appeals. I ask for your support of reasonable height limits as called for in the comprehensive plan. The other issue I'd like to highlight about historic districts, especially residential ones as shown in the slide to the right, is our support of increasing density. Historic districts are not about keeping renters and smaller units out. In fact, we would like to be an active partner in finding ways to make sure more rental units and more density occurs. We have a request related to this aspect too, which is your support of the amendment on the table for a demolition disincentive for actual designated historic properties under the residential infill project. Though we'd love to see a disincentive for demolishing any old property, the amendment on the table is exactly in line with what got passed in the Better Housing by Design project. So finally here, I'd like to highlight a couple of our chosen projects of the year so we can end with a few wins as well. I do have to mention we're troubled by the position of some city agencies who effectively are allowing demolition by neglect on several historic properties in the public trust. But the private sector, as shown here, continues to demonstrate leadership, contextual understanding, and creativity. So just quickly, the Halleck McMillan Building restoration, that's the winner in the category of a rehabilitation project. And then under the category of new construction is the PAE Living Building, which is gonna be going up soon, we hope, in the Skidmore Old Town District. So I think that effectively ends my presentation for now. I know we have four people who are ready to testify, several of whom have slides tacked on to the end of my presentation. So if it's okay, Mayor, I'll go ahead and close my screen for now and open it back up to share those slides when those testifiers come
up. Yeah, Kristen, thank you for that excellent presentation. Why don't we go ahead and do that, colleagues? Let's hear from the invited testimony, just so we can keep the momentum going here. And if you could hold your questions for Kristen until after we've heard from the guest testimony as well. All right, Kristen, thank you. I'll let you introduce your testimony.
Okay, I might need to ask for help remembering whether first on the list was going to be Kim Moreland or Lou McLemore. I guess I'm looking for either Hillary or Kimberly. I see you raising your hand. Perhaps you're ready then to go first.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the City Council and Historic Landmark Commission. My name is Kimberly Moreland, and I'm on the board of the Oregon Black Pioneers and the Bosco Milligan Foundation, also called the Architectural Heritage Center. I'm also a governor-appointed member of the Oregon Heritage Commission. For over 30 years, I have worked on a number of projects related to the history of African Americans in Portland and also involved in the preservation of historic African-American buildings, including bus tours that highlight buildings related to African-American history. I also worked on the Cornerstone document and the multiple property documentation of African-American resources. The Historic Landmark Commission and goals and priorities are critical to promoting a robust preservation program that emphasizes rehabilitation rather than demolition. As the HLC report states, preservation matters. I would also say that preserving historic buildings related to African Americans provide many benefits to the Portland community. Prioritizing the preservation of marginalized communities tells a more inclusive Portland story. Preservation tours such as the MPD and the National Register of Historic Places designation allow African-American historic resources to reap the benefits that the historic destination offer. the Golden West Hotel, Dean Beauty and Barbershop, and a building that is currently occupied by Terry Funeral Home, which was also occupied by Dr. Marshall's medical office and the Black Panther Dental Clinic, are just a few cultural and historic properties that should be recognized for their historic significance. Preservation tools can be utilized to save the remnants of African-American historic properties and protect them from development pressures. Home Forward recently named their flagship affordable housing project after Louisa Flowers. Louisa and Allen Flowers lived in the Elliott neighborhood. Allen Flowers arrived in Portland in 1865, and his wife, Louisa, arrived in 1882 when she married Allen Irvin. The couple had four children and became civic leaders and built several homes in Lower Albina in the Elliott neighborhood in 1885. As the Home Forward building, named in Louisa honor, was being constructed, the Flowers' two remaining homes, built in 1885 on Schuyler Street, was being deconstructed and demolished. In conclusion, I think it's important that the City Council supports the Historic Landmark Commission effort to realize equity-driven outcomes in the preservation movement. Brent Lent, an executive director of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Plan, says it's best. Preservation is about community. Each site stands as a historical indicator of our complex presence. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next up, I think, is Lou McLemore.
Yes, good morning, everyone. My name is Lou McLemore. I'm the exalted ruler for Billy Webb's Elks Lodge. I've been the exalted ruler there for the last 7 years. Billy Webb's Elks Lodge has been one of the, I guess you can say, a centerpiece of the Black community for the last 85 years. And we are presently, we're presently closed, but prior to that, we have been active in the community, doing some coat drives. We hold an annual party for the kids, for Halloween, for Easter. We do a number of different things. This year, our project had started out to be sickle cell anemia in partnership with a coalition of Black men. And those are some of the projects that we're currently working on. We had a shoe drive that was going to start in April, but again, that's been knocked out. But those are some of the types of things that we do with at Billy Webb's Elks Lodge. It's been a little different trying to do a nonprofit with the COVID-19 going on right now. We're looking at trying to get ourselves situated to be reopened and be able to get back into the game again. We do a lot of different parties. We do a lot of different, hold a lot of different events. We rent out our building to the community so that events can be held there. So Billy Webb's Elks Lodge has been a real central part of the community. But in this situation, we have not been able to do anything that we would be doing. I can tell you that we were the headquarters for the Vanport flood. For the community, the Red Cross has been in our building also. It used to be the USO. Just a little background history on it. It used to be the USO for the Black soldiers. So we've been a real integral part in the community, and we're still trying to be that at this point.
Thank you, Lou.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, I believe it's you, Brian. And I'm going to go ahead and share my screen so that I'm showing your slides, Brian, and I probably won't be able to see you. So just, you know, let me know when I need to change slides. Let's see if this will work again.
Sounds good. Thanks, Kristen, and good morning, City Council and Commissioners. My name is Brian Emmerich. I'm the principal of Emmerich Architects and former chair of the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission. And I want to thank you guys all for your time and holding space for this important conversation in our community around preservation and the goals with that. I'm going to talk briefly about unreinforced masonry buildings through a case study that is a project we recently completed in the Portland Chinatown district at Northwest 4th and Davis. It's the Overland Warehouse project, which you see the before picture there on your screen. This is visible now completed through that Chinatown gate shot you saw earlier in the presentation. It's only two blocks away, so it's quite a turnaround. It's hard to imagine a building in worse shape than this. It was built in 1889, most of it abandoned in the 1960s, with the exception of the oldest running strip club in the ground floor when we started the project. And now, go ahead and flip slides, Kristen, to the next, please. This is a couple of the shots of what it looked like beforehand. You can flip to the next one. And this is it was an important Chinese tenement housing before in its previous history. Go ahead and switch slides. And this is the after shot. Now it's an anchor in the community. It was a full seismic upgrade. It's about 40,000 square feet, including the basement. And the costs without tenant improvements were about $4 million. So around a little over $100 a square foot. And the seismic component of that was about $50 a square foot. So it shows these projects are really achievable, and they add a huge contribution to the community. This was done speculatively by the Urban Development and Partnership Group and ended up attracting Mouvel, which is a leading technology transit firm who's built the entire building and actually incentivized preservation of the neighboring building. You see the white one to the west, the Crown Zellerbach Annex, which also subsequently received a full upgrade, and Mouvel actually took space in that building as well. So it really became a turnaround story of how to incrementally start changing these neighborhoods in need and preserving our cultural heritage in our community for forward generations. These projects are challenging because, you know, with height and zoning density increase, even the best preservation outcomes don't exceed what you can do with financial rewards with new development. So the problem is that with the new development and the bigger buildings, we lose a piece of our memory and our cultural heritage. And so it's really important that we think about overall goals with our community when we're thinking about these kinds of problems and how to solve them. So with that, there's a takeaway at the beginning of the presentation if you want to look into more information on these projects and issues. But that, I'll stop there.
Great.
Oh, sorry, Kristen, more slides.
Let's see. Okay, I think.
Yeah, these are the finished product. There's kind of
over. Yeah.
Upgrade stuff there.
Okay, that was your last slide, I think.
Yeah, that's the last slide there, yeah.
See, okay.
Inside now.
I think I promised them at one point the last time I visited that I someday would walk across that beam. The atrium. I haven't quite worked up the courage to do it yet, but it's still on the bucket list.
Yeah, I'm sure you won't be the first, Mayor Wheeler.
I was assured that I would have been the first, although I didn't believe it for a minute.
That's great.
Okay. So after Brian, my next presenter or testifier is Paul Schwert. And I've got some slides for you. So if you can hear me, just let me know.
I can hear you. Can you hear me? All right. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I'm Paul Schwer. I'm the president of PAE Engineers, and we're really excited about this news project you're about to hear about. It'll be the Portland PAE's Living Building. For those of you who don't know PAE, we're a 350-person engineering company that was founded in Portland back in 1967. If you go to the next slide. Our site is the corner of Southwest First and Pine in the Skidmore Old Town District, which is a really cool part of town close to the river. A lot of development is happening in that area now, so we're really excited about this community. If you go to the next slide. This is the Portland National Bank that was built in the 1880s and was demolished in the 1950s and turned, for some reason, into a surface parking lot. So historic preservation wasn't what it is now. So if you go to the next slide. So that parking lot is now going to be turned into our new living building. And we really appreciate the openness of the Historic Landmark Commission that they showed during the design of this building and the input they provided with it. You know, their approach to both preserving the past, but being forward thinking about what's important for the future of the city is a really kind of great balance. And Justin Brooks from ZGF, who's the designer of this project, he said the goal of our project was to design a building that is of its time, but timeless in its response to the historic context. So how do you balance that, a brand new building in a historic area? If you go to the next slide. So on top of all that, we wanted to design it as a living building. So this building will be net zero energy, net zero water, net zero waste, and carbon negative. Essentially, this building will meet the city's 2050 climate goals 30 years ahead of schedule. And if that wasn't challenging enough, as engineers, we always like to add things on top of it. It will be designed to seismic category 4, which is the same as fire stations and hospitals. So it will survive pretty large seismic events. Next slide. We hope it will last 500 years. Part of the design was based on the golden ratio, which you see in historic architecture and the Fibonacci series, which is both in historic architecture and in nature. And those ratios that are then applied to the facade of our building, one of the reasons it's so appealing is these systems we see in nature as human beings, we're kind of attracted to those ratios. Next slide. One of the things that we worked on with the Historic Commission was the detailing of the top of the building. The tops of historic buildings typically have some type of extra detailing. This is what ours will look like on the fifth floor. The Landmarks Commission was also open to new materials as long as they were high quality. There was some fiberglass windows in there, which is the very long-lasting windows. Next slide. And we chose this part of town because of the zoning. We're building a 75-foot tall building, which is the max zoning in that area. And since we need solar access to generate energy for our building, the three or four blocks to the south of us are all part of the historic district, and they also will protect our solar access. Next slide. So we hope next summer that many of you will be able to join us in a party in this space. Once the building is built, it is officially under construction. We're a hole in the ground now, and next summer it will look like this on the fifth floor. And the final slide. And just to remind everyone, this is a developer-led, privately financed project. It's the first developer-led living building in the world. We hope it is a replicable model that other buildings in Portland and throughout the nation and the world can follow of carbon negative projects that are new. And we had a fantastic design and construction team to do it. And we're really excited to see it come out of the ground and appreciate the support of the mayor and the city council during the permit review process. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Does that complete the invited testimony?
Yes, I was the last one.
You're the last one. Okay, you wrapped it up well. Colleagues, any questions for any of our panelists? I see Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mayor. And thank all of you for what an incredible presentation. I actually am always fascinated with the old pictures of Portland and kind of how sometimes we get it right and sometimes we don't quite get it right, but the history lesson is always fascinating. I really want to appreciate Lou from Billy Elks Web Lodge because I think Lou was very modest when he talked about the role that the Elks Lodge has played in the African-American community for so long. The NAACP used to meet there when it couldn't meet anywhere else. Lou talked about being a club for soldiers who needed a break coming back from wartime. And I have to say, I am just so thrilled with the renovation of Billy Webb's Elks Club and how it has continued its historic mission at really being a centerpiece and a centering for the African-American community here. So much love and respect for that. Kimberly, the work that you have done over the years have just been pretty remarkable. You've been so consistent in trying to preserve a history that is disappearing before our eyes. And so I also want to thank you for your work, not just with this commission, but with all the other work that you've done around the state to preserve our history. I'm fascinated by the presentation by Brian Emmerich, because Brian, what you talked about was also a private development opportunity that really was focused on preservation and making sure that we did not lose the culture of the area that building was renovated in. We always hear that in the development world, it's about building as quickly, as efficiently, and getting the most out of whatever it is you're building. How do you create the will to have investors come in and look at a property and make them think that the investment for preservation is better and greater than just tearing it down and building some steel something or other in its place?
That's a great question, Joanne. I think it starts with having a visionary developer who can get where you can go with that. I think that, like, for Mouvel, who would ultimately realize the final potential in that building, that's what they were looking for, and that's something that Portland offers. We've got this huge historic footprint relative to our community size, and those types of creative kind of cutting edge companies aren't looking to be in a Class A office space. They're looking for something more unique, and that's really where you're selling kind of the value of the finished product. Is, you know, it's over a century old and it's got all these layers of history and culture, and it's a really rich experience, and you're looking for the right visionary who connects with that, I think, because then you get really exponential value out of that. It's not something you can replicate with a new building.
And it's certainly not as the city. I mean, how do you think the city council, maybe I'll change my question a bit. How do you think the city council can be more helpful in these kind of conversations early on so that we are in fact looking at the very best use of buildings rather than just somebody comes in, we give them a permit and off they go. How can we be more helpful as a city council? Because I have to say, I'm a big fan of old buildings. I'm a big fan of old wood. And I know that a lot of the new properties, they look good, but they don't have that feel of history. So what can we do as city council to help actually elevate the work that you've done and others have done as part of this commission?
Well, that's a great question also. And I think you could have a more in-depth conversation with the Landmarks Commission currently. But I would say, you know, starting with like the Overland Warehouse, that's an unreinforced masonry building. We have about 1,800 of those in our inventory. Many of those are not actually historically designated, even though they are historic. I call them historic with a lowercase h. And in Oregon, it's really hard to get property designation on the register without owner consent. In fact, it's impossible. So that's actually been a big movement. We're one of the only, I think, two states in the nation that don't have that. So without that ability and kind of lobbying at the state level for some of these things, and Mayor Wheeler mentioned the historic tax credit, some of these financial incentive things where Portland is a powerhouse and has the most historic buildings in the state. We can really be advocates at that state level to get support on that bigger area. And then also just realizing that, you know, the Landmarks Commission has been lobbying for, since I was on the commission the whole 8 years, and still now for this historic resource inventory. Without knowing what our resources are in the community, it's really hard to be able to start crafting legislation around how are we gonna protect these strategically. So I think those are some things to be thinking about with that, and just knowing that, you know, these buildings represent really part of our community's collective memory and our identity, and we need to hold on to that. That's super important to who we are as a city and our culture and our people here. So recognizing that value first and then working on strategies of how to support and incentivize that, I think is probably the key.
Thank you, Brian. That was really helpful. It made me think of Geneva's barbershop has just announced after 30 years that it's going to close. Talk about a corner that's also been the center of African-American activity, whether you got your hair did there or not, or you just kind of hung out because you knew that there were other people that looked good that were hanging out near that location. I am curious, maybe Kristen's the appropriate person to answer this. What is the timeline normally to get a building designated as a historic site? And are we too late or too early in the process to start talking about how do we get Geneva's that designation?
Thank you for mentioning that. I also saw that in the paper, and that, and I included an image in my very first slide. I don't know if you noticed that.
I can see it, yes.
Okay. So it typically can take up to a year. And part of the problem there is that there's a state advisory board that only meets 3 times a year. And so, you know, trying to get the timing of that and show up in front of them and then get their approval to go on to, you know, the National Park Service is what sort of takes the long time. But, you know, that timeline, depending on when the meetings fall, could certainly be compressed to maybe as little as 8 months. It takes a little while.
Well, let me know how I can be helpful, because I think if we don't try, it won't happen. Right. And so we should just figure out what we need to do to at least put the effort in, because I would imagine that once again, once it's gone, it's gone. And that legacy and that history will also be gone. So I'll just stop there. I do have one more question. I'm fascinated by Paul's building, the one on Southwest First and Pine. And you talked about this as a living building, zero energy, zero waste, a building that will put the city of Portland, I wrote a note, 30 years ahead of our climate goals, right? That's a really bodacious statement to make. And I'm all for bodacious statements, right? But I wanna know, like, the devil's in the details about a living building that you are setting yourself up to be just like 30 years ahead of the time. How is that gonna happen in this building?
Thanks, Commissioner. I love being called bodacious. That's fantastic at a city council meeting. So basically, you know, some of the goals that the city has are to be climate neutral by 2050. So powered by 100% renewable energy. And so what our building is, it's all powered by renewable energy. So going forward, it's net zero energy. As we build it, we've actually calculated the carbon intensity of every piece of lumber in that building, every piece of concrete, and then we do a one-time offset, hopefully within the Oregon region, offsetting the emissions that it took to build the building. And then going forward, since we're actually going to be generating more energy than we need, we're carbon negative from that point on. So if you think of it from a carbon standpoint, from day one, we'll be neutral and then go down. We are collecting all the rainfall on the roof of the building. That will be the water that's used in the building. Essentially, this building is trying to mimic the ecosystem that was in Portland pre-development. You know, go back 250 years, there were no buildings here. What happened? A tree growing in that exact location had the budget, its budget was the sun. and its rainfall was its water budget. Can we design buildings that meet within that budget? And that's the goal for this building and the living building challenge in general.
I am loving this. I am hoping that some of the expertise that has been brought together for that building will also help as the Portland Clean Energy Fund starts working on what does our energy future look like. I see some real opportunities for some innovation and creativity. And so once again, thank you all. I can geek out on this stuff all day, so I'm gonna
I'm gonna
politely just step aside and let my other colleagues ask questions. But I wanna once again really appreciate this extraordinary work that you continue to do and that you do it from a position of love. Because since we don't pay any of you to do the work that you're doing, it is clear that you are driven by something other than a financial return on this work. So thank you all very much for this really important work and for this fine report that you presented today.
Very good, colleagues. Others, Commissioner Fritz, you're next up.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the fabulous presentation. My goodness, I really enjoyed it, appreciated it, felt it. It was really, really fabulous. I'm hopeful that you will all come back when we do the Central City 2035 readoption, and in particular, the Heights in Old Town Chinatown Historic District. And I'm just wondering, since the proposal is still kind of being formulated, would anybody like to comment on the Heights in the historic district?
Commissioner Fritz, are you asking if any of the Landmarks commissioners wish to comment, or are you asking your fellow city councilors?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're the experts. I was asking the Landmarks commissioners. As I say, you know, the proposal will be coming to council, and so it would be helpful to have, I do hope you'll all testify, you'll each one testify at the hearing. And also would appreciate any input that you, Kristen, would like to give right now, or if anybody else would like to give it.
Okay, thank you so much. Just to touch on that briefly, it's the Landmarks position that all the work that was done by various city groups and representatives of that neighborhood, you know, that was hammered out over several years, was kind of immediately put aside, and there was a spot zone put on a particular lot. I understand it's a, you know, it is a lot without any development on it, but we still perceive that as being done without the necessary understanding of what that historic district really is, which is, you know, it's only two blocks wide, you know, five blocks long. It's very small. So we would advocate for the Central City 2035 to go back to those heights that were developed as part of the community input of Central City 35.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions while my colleagues are thinking if they have others. As you all know, Portland, like every other West Coast city, is growing. But unique to Oregon, of course, is the urban growth boundary. And this protects our farms, it protects our forests, and it obviously encourages us to build walkable neighborhoods. And I guess my question ultimately for you is, in what ways can you see the Historic Landmarks Commission helping the city to manage this growth in both a sustainable as well as an inclusive manner? This is a unique aspect to Oregon. It's unique to development. It creates these pressures around both protection versus managing growth. In what ways can you help us both in terms of inclusivity as well as sustainability?
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler. If I have to talk about historic districts alone, which, you know, obviously we advocate for any old building outside of historic districts, but within historic districts, a lot of which are solely residential, we are strongly advocating for ways to increase density. And we do support the idea that there be allowances for far more residential density as proposed in RIP. But we are concerned that, you know, once you start sort of setting some of these very large envelopes, I guess I'll say, that some of them are out of context. So we're looking really for ways to be able to change code, and that might allow for us to put, say, 4 or even 5 units within some of these very large older buildings that right now are single family homes, you know, maybe just an older couple are rattling around in there. We could really help do more if we addressed codes and if we saw incentives and encouragement for adapting backyard garages and for putting up ADUs. So we can do more on all three of those fronts to increase.
Well, and I don't think you'd find any disagreement on this city council, and you certainly wouldn't find any disagreement with me. I strongly support each and every one of those strategies that you mentioned. So I think there's ways for us to continue to work together. And I'd really like us to continue to partner down in Salem for some of those incentives that we talked about early. Oregon's out of step with other states. And as you had noted in the past, Kristen, in previous testimony, Portland actually is the home to many of our historic structures. And we know that Portland is going to continue. You know, we'll get through the economic crisis and eventually we'll come out on the other side. And we'll go right back onto that growth curve that we had previously. And there will be a lot of pressure around development and redevelopment. And without those adequate both protections on one hand, and I know Commissioner Fritz has been very, very forceful and convincing in her arguments on the protections side, but we also have to think about the incentive side. And I feel like sometimes that part of the discussion gets short shrift. So I thank you in particular for bringing it up. My second question is just an acknowledgement. First of all, we recently received a report from Bureau of Planning and Sustainability titled "The Historical Context of Racist Planning." And that was provocative, and it was provocative intentionally because we wanted the community to know and to understand that there is a history of systemic racism in this community that bleeds over into the current, into the present day. And I know I sound like a broken record when I say this, but it traces back to very harmful and intentionally discriminatory practices in our community. And it was done to exclude communities of color, particularly people who are Black and Indigenous. It separated those populations in particular, but not exclusively, from homeownership opportunities, from the opportunities to create intergenerational wealth, and frankly, to protect the public health and the environmental stability of the areas in which those individuals live. You raised that again today, and I'm really pleased with the fact that we do raise these issues intentionally. But in what ways can your commission help the city work to remedy some of those harms that are legacy harms that to a great degree still exist today? How can we work together to address those issues which you raised as part of this report?
Mayor Willer, there's one thing in our report that we have touched on, which is the idea that as a commission that we began doing active outreach to especially inner Albina communities of color and see if we can really achieve a sort of ground up understanding of what places are still important to the community, what places we can help to preserve or to commemorate in some cases if something is already gone. And I think in that way, we can really, maybe step back and let other voices take charge of, what is important really. Do any other commissioners, I'm sort of monopolizing the conversation. If anyone else would like to, you know, help add to this conversation, I would love it if you're...
Looks like Derek has some thoughts.
Great.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and City Council. This is Commissioner Spears on the Historic Landmark Commission. Earlier in the presentation, Chair Miner talked about the Legacy Business Program, and I think it's one of those opportunities we have to take a step from other cities. San Antonio and San Francisco implemented these in 2013 and 2018 in different phases. We know preservation has long been tied to ownership, and this program has helped those who have not been able to own their locations. And they also created what they call was a Legacy Business Preservation Fund that provided grants to both business owners and property owners, which has been crucial during the COVID-19 crisis. I think what this program does is that it helps to find those businesses that are also part of the communities to help establish and keep those communities whole, because a lot of times what happens in development is that the businesses are lost along the way too, because those businesses don't own those areas. So I think this is one of those programs that would be beneficial in this conversation, along with a lot of other things that we need to come up with to continue to push this narrative forward on how we can be more instrumental in how we help preserve and also help grow this city.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate that response very much. And then I share my colleagues' interest in the design. I learned something new today. I knew that there were sort of these classic lines and dimensions to architecture, but I didn't always understand the direct tie to nature. I thought that was really fascinating. So I appreciate sort of the quick introduction to architectural design, and it actually makes me want to learn more. I mean, that was fascinating to me.
Be careful, Mayo. That is coming from an engineer. So there's architects on this call that know 10 times, 100 times what I know, but it's fascinating to me too as an engineer, because we try to mimic nature in our designs.
Well, it's great. And when I saw the building, I commented to my colleague, wow, I love that, but I really couldn't articulate why I did. And so maybe you helped answer some of that question. There's just something about the way our brains work and the way we think and the way we view dimensions in nature that's innate. And I appreciate you connecting that to what maybe helps us view one building as good architecture and another as bad architecture, even if we can't articulate why we think that. So that to me was sort of a big aha moment. So thank you for that. And I'm excited to see that even in the midst of the COVID economic downturn, we're seeing a renewed interest in the use of natural construction materials. Your building is a fabulous example. And of course, there was another one just announced recently on the east side that's going to be a CLT building. And of course, the city council supported framework, which unfortunately didn't work out given some of the financing issues. But I'm hopeful that as we recover, we'll continue to think about our environmental resilience strategies. And I appreciate the way you approach your project. I had a question for Lou. Lou raised something that was really interesting to me around the Elks Lodge. Lou, can you just give me a couple of points? How are you guys doing during this COVID crisis? I assume you're not meeting. Does that put you and the Elks in any danger of not being able to hang on to that facility? Or how are you getting through this immediate COVID crisis?
Well, right now we're pretty much we're hanging in there, but we will need some help to get some things done. I've looked at the PPP program that can't do anything for us because of the payback situation and us being a nonprofit and not having anything coming in the last couple of months makes it really kind of difficult. So we're gonna struggle getting open, depending upon what the rules are, and that's gonna have a lot to do with how we can reopen.
All right. Well, I want to make sure you don't lose control of that facility. So I may have a member of my team reach out to you and connect with you. And just I'd like us to stay in the loop and make sure that we obviously don't have unlimited resources or capacity. But the good news is we all know people who do. So
good. I appreciate that.
It'd be helpful. And I also want to acknowledge it's not only a great facility, it's being used for a really altruistic and community-based purpose. And I want to thank you for your passion, your commitment to service to the community.
My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. I don't have any further questions. Unless any of my colleagues do, I will entertain a motion and a second at this time to accept the report.
I'll move to accept the report.
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Hardesty. We have a second from Commissioner Fritz. Any further discussion on this item? Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Some days I'm just giddy to vote yes on opportunities, and today is one of those days. I want to thank you, Mayor, for your last comment regarding the Elks Lodge. I am going to also make my staff available to help in any way that we can, because we cannot afford to lose any additional institutions in the city of Portland. So I am very happy to vote aye.
You Daly.
Well, thank you for the report. I really appreciate the focus on equity.
Chloe, you muted by accident.
There we go.
Yep.
Thank you for the report. I want to appreciate the focus on equity, affordability, and sustainability as high priorities in the report. I appreciated the mayor's comments, and I'm also very intrigued by the possibility of pursuing restorative justice through zoning and historic designation. Acknowledging how racist public policies have harmed the Black community in the past is great, but it's not enough, and I strongly believe that we have to pursue remedies that deliver tangible benefit to property owners and to the larger community. And preserving those spaces is absolutely vital. I was also very excited to hear you mention support for legacy businesses. I've actually researched the Legacy Business Program in San Francisco, and I have been advocating for a similar approach as well as the reestablishment of the Small Business Advisory Council, which is two steps Portland could take to recognize and better serve our local small businesses. So please count me in for conversations on that, as well as the remedies we're talking about today. I'm very happy to vote aye.
Fritz?
Aye. Thank you. I was diving from my unmute button. This is one of my favorite presentations of the year. It's one that I will definitely be tuning into next year from home. Well, I am from home and right now, but thank you to the Landmarks Commission. Very professional presentation, absolutely first class. It always is, but this one, I think you've actually outdone yourself, and very timely. And the good news, colleagues, is that we have some opportunities coming up that we can actually make a difference on the values and principles that have been stated by the Landmarks Commission, and which each of you have endorsed, with the expanding opportunities conversation tomorrow, with the Central City 2035 conversation, with the residential infill project amendment that Chair Minor mentioned to avoid incenting demolition of historic buildings. These are all things that we as the council can do to actively make a difference. And for the most part, pretty much they don't cost any money, and they don't inhibit density or housing. They enhance it, and they can certainly further our climate action goals. We're about to be discussing a resiliency resolution, and the mention of why the height limits open give certainty that the solar access will still be there. We don't have solar access requirements in the zoning code anymore. And so height is the only way that buildings can be, height limits is the only way that buildings can know what to expect. And so again, these are practical things that, we, the council, can choose to do or not do. And I hope that each one of the Landmarks commissioners and those who testified today will have enjoyed the experience of dialing in and being able to do so from home, and will sign up to testify on the other projects that are coming up, because it's so very important. Thank you so much. Thank you also to Hilary Adam and Cara Fioravanti in the Bureau of Development Services, along with Brandon Spencer Hartle. Thanks to Claire Adamsick and Tim Crail on my staff. We very much appreciate all of the work that's been done. Hi.
Wheeler.
Well, I want to thank you all for a fantastic and provocative and really interesting report. That was great. And I'm energized by what I heard. And the passion that you all exude is contagious. So thank you for the great work you do. I always learn something new when I hear these presentations. And today was certainly no exception. Really, really proud of the work you're doing on behalf of the community. I also want to thank the Bureau of Development Services, Cara Fioravanti and Hilary Adams, for working to make sure that the commission is diligently managed and overseen. I appreciate all the hard work and recognize that this report does in no way encapsulate all of the really, really tough decisions and conversations that are happening under the commission's purview. And I want to thank each and every one of you personally for your dedication and your leadership. I am very happy, and this is a easy yes vote. I'm actually already looking forward to the DVD version and the movie version of this coming out soon, and I'll look forward to next year's presentation. And we have a lot of work to do together in the interim. So thank you all. Happy to vote aye. The report is accepted. Terrific presentation. Thank you all for participating today. Next up, Carla, and looks like we're on time here for next time certain item is 377.
Amend the City of Portland Employee Benefits Program to reflect necessary plan design changes as recommended by the Labor Management Benefits Committee and as administratively required by the Bureau of Human Resources for the city's plan offerings beginning July 1, 2020 through June 30, 2021.
Well, the bar has been set very high for interesting and provocative conversations this morning, and I hope this will be equally interesting and provocative. Every year, colleagues, as you know, the city's Labor Management Benefits Committee reviews the employee benefits programs and provides recommendations for any necessary changes. The first ordinance would approve, you know what, Carla? No, never mind. The first ordinance would approve the fiscal year 2021 benefit plan document addressing recommendations by the Labor Management Benefits Committee in addition to state and federally mandated changes. The second ordinance would approve additional funding for employee assistance program services provided by Cascade Centers to continue services for city benefits plan participants. Cascade Centers has been the city's EAP provider since 2011. The Employee Assistance Program is a comprehensive service that provides resources and confidential consultation on a variety of personal issues city employees may be experiencing, and it's designed to provide early intervention to promote employee health and wellness. The council will take these ordinances separately, but I understand that the Bureau of Human Resources will provide comments to both ordinances during their remarks. Kathy Bless, Deputy Chief Human Resources Officer, and Michelle Taylor, Benefits Supervisor, are on the call to walk us through the ordinances. And I'll let you guys take it from here. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mayor. Thank you so much, and good morning, Commissioners and the Mayor. Kathy Bless, Chief Human Resource Officer with the City of Portland. I hope that we can be as provocative as the prior presentation. What I would like to do is to turn over the remarks to Michelle Taylor. She is the one that has completed all of the work getting ready for the annual enrollment that is currently underway and also in planning and working with the LMBC. So I will turn it over to Michelle.
Kathy, before you turn it over to Michelle, Carla, I had one little oversight here. Could you also read the time certain item 378? That's the companion ordinance to this. And I'm sorry, I just missed that in my original record keeping here.
Mm-hmm. 378, approve $500,000 in additional funding for the Cascade Centers, Inc. contract administered by the Bureau of Human Resources, Health and Financial Benefits Office for Employee Assistance Plan Services through June 30, 2021.
Thank you. Sorry, Michelle, to interrupt. Go ahead, please.
No worries. Thank you so much. Thank you, Kathy, for the introduction. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Michelle Taylor, Benefits Supervisor within the Bureau of Human Resources, and I'm here this morning to talk about our two ordinances. No pressure whatsoever for my first time presenting to council, so that's a tough act to follow, but I'll give it a try. Before diving in, I'd love to take a moment just to kind of highlight some of the great work that's been provided by the benefit team during this COVID-19 pandemic. Our team implemented the new Families First Coronavirus Response Act and the city's COVID Catastrophic Leave Program. These required a tremendous amount of additional work on staff who tirelessly ensured accuracy in administration and provided education to employees so they can make informed decisions concerning their well-being. Our occupational health and well-being team has been at the forefront of this pandemic, working with the ECC, bureaus, unions, and leadership. Very early on, our occupational health and well-being manager was involved in monitoring outbreaks, providing resources, and helped advise the city on how to best prepare for its eventual arrival. The team provides guidance to work groups regarding re-entry into facilities and supports employee mental health and well-being as we adapt to this new normal. Our benefit offerings have also been subject to changes, such as withdrawal options for our 457 deferred compensation plan through the CARES Act, COBRA extension of deadlines, and the most recent changes to the flexible spending accounts, which allow participants an extended deadline to incur claims. Therefore, employees are at less risk of losing their contributions as many of them face financial hardships. All changes have impacted the workload of our staff, but they have never skipped a beat. They understand the unique needs of city employees, dependents, and retirees, and continue providing exceptional service to all. We would be facing different outcomes if it weren't for this incredible team, which makes up the Health and Financial Benefit Office, in addition to the leadership that we receive from our Chief Human Resources Officer. I would also like to take a moment to thank our valued partners within the Labor Management Benefit Committee, who have collaborated on plan changes, which respect the fiscal responsibility and sustainability required to protect the health fund. We also collaborated with the Portland Police Association in making strategic and fiscally responsible decisions for their plan as well. I'd like to thank our longstanding vendor partners for their continued support in providing innovative benefits which meet the needs of our employees and dependents. Lastly, I would like to express our appreciation to Commissioner Fritz and her staff, especially Tim and Claire, for their continued support and flexibility as we honor the desire and interest to forge a path towards equitable fertility benefits. Our first ordinance, number 377, authorizes the health plan document for the new benefit plan year beginning July 1 of 2020. While the plan documents represent the legal requirements of the health plan and the health reimbursement account, by approving this ordinance, you are also approving plan design changes recommended by the Labor Management Benefit Committee and for the administrative requirements which BHR and the Benefit Office are responsible to fulfill. Changes recommended by the LMBC include additional EAP visits, which I'll talk about in the next ordinance, continued enhancements in no-cost mental health copays, limiting out-of-pocket costs only to the deductible for inpatient mental health, pharmacy changes targeting specialty medications which reduce costs for the participant and for the city, minor dental changes, important COVID-related enhancements, and a commitment from the LMBC to continue fertility discussions within the Fertility and Family Planning Subcommittee, working toward an equitable offering with a tentative effective date of January 1, 2021. Based on the LMBC changes described, the final health premium costs and self-funded rates increased approximately 3.3% citywide for fiscal year 2020-2021. The health operating fund budgets include appropriations in support of health plan costs associated with this ordinance. And as in prior years, we draw down health operating fund reserves to lessen cost impacts to bureaus and to employees. This has been an important strategy to balance against high increases. Our second ordinance, 378, seeks an additional $500,000 in funding for employee assistance program services provided by Cascade Center's EAP. There is no change to the contract terms as a result of this ordinance. As the mayor stated, Cascade Centers has been the city's EAP provider and partner since 2011. This is the last year of our five-year contract extension. The city will be required to seek competitive bids through a request for proposal process for fiscal year 2021-2022. Additional funding is necessary to address increases in participant counts over the length of this contract, prior increases in the number of visits for our first responders, the addition of an online mental health platform called Whole Life Directions, and to support the additional 5 confidential counseling sessions as mentioned earlier. This brings the total number of confidential counseling visits to 13 for our PPA and PFFA groups, and 10 for all of our other union and non-represented groups. The additional EAP counseling options address gaps in care for current Kaiser participants by allowing for additional provider choice and privacy protection. As required by the Mental Health Parity Act, these steps ensure the continued freedom to independently manage mental health and increases this benefit for all employees, regardless of their health plan choice. The requested funds are available within the health operating fund, and Kaiser is offsetting its premium to make the increase for the additional visits cost neutral for its participants. I would ask for your support in authorizing these ordinances, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you for that excellent presentation. Well done. And does that complete your overall presentation?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Colleagues, any questions before I ask if there is public testimony? I can't find myself. Where am I? Here I am. There I am. I'm back. Colleagues, no further questions at this particular moment? Very good. Carla, is there any public testimony?
Yes, Mayor. I believe we have 2 people signed up. We'll go with Carly Smith.
All right. Three minutes each. Name for the record, please. Carly, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Well, loud and clear. You're good to go.
Wonderful. Thank you for letting me speak today. Over the last few months, I have been preparing for one of the most life-changing journeys a person can embark on. I'm thankful to be in a place where parenthood is something that is within my reach. I knew that with this decision, I would be faced with challenges from the very beginning. I'm a single queer woman of color, and for me, the natural process to become a parent looks very different from what my hetero counterparts experience. While I was researching IVF, IUI, and other treatments available, I was immediately met with the reality that these needed procedures were not covered by my insurance plan. And if I wanted them to be, I would need to change my entire health plan. So I would no longer be able to get care from my doctor, who I have been seeing for years. I would no longer be able to get care at the facility that I have been going to for years. So my choice is to pay completely out of pocket or endure complete health care upheaval. Ultimately, my decision to utilize IUI was because of affordability, even though a better choice for me would be IVF. This doesn't seem like a fair choice. It feels punitive. And the question is, why should I be forced to choose this way just because my natural way of starting a family requires a different type of care? I believe that there are barriers to what is my natural process to become a parent. So I'd like to recognize the important work that the Fertility Benefits Committee subcommittee is doing to be truly supportive of families like mine, and to encourage this council to adopt changes that reduce barriers for people like me and my family. Fertility treatment should be covered under all healthcare plans that the city provides for its employees. Thank you.
Thank you, Carly. We appreciate it.
Next is,
No, go ahead.
Next is Jennifer Kane.
Welcome, Jennifer. Is it Jennifer Kane or is it, are you sure you have the right last name there, Carla?
It's K-A-I-N.
And it's not Jen Cairo.
She's on the attendees list, Mayor, on your...
Okay, Jen Kane, are you muted?
I am. I'm sorry.
That was a mistake.
I did not sign up for a public testimony. I'm just participating in the call.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you for participating. We appreciate it. Commissioner Fritz. Commissioner Fritz, you're muted.
Yes, I was, and I was trying to find it. It's very difficult toggling back between the screen where I have my comments written and the session, so sorry about that. So I just wanted to give some more context about the fertility treatments and to thank the team who've been working on it. I brought the request for the expanded fertility coverage to the Labor Management Benefits Committee to explore in the current fiscal year. And I highlighted the city's commitment to being an employer of choice, attracting and retaining a diverse, culturally competent, fully engaged workforce, providing excellent public services, and adding to our package of inclusive benefits, which currently include paid sick time, paid parental leave, including for foster and adoptive parents, cognitive behavioral therapy for autism, and transgender health care, all of which I've been a part of getting included over the 12 years that I've been on the council. And it makes me smile just to think of the changes and the improvements that that the team at Human Resources has made over the past 12 years to provide healthcare benefits to our valued employees. So to inform the Labor Management Benefits Committee in discussion, Claire Adamsick on my staff utilized the diverse empowered employees of Portland to collect testimony from city staff willing to share their experience. And thank you to Carly Smith for being willing to do that on this in this meeting. These employees highlighted the difficult choices that they had to make between what they could afford for out-of-pocket for fertility treatments versus what may have been the best route for them medically, as we just heard from Carly. They described the mental health impacts from the cost burden of support deemed elective, which is an inherent barrier for people whose path to parenting is only possible with some level of medical or agency support. And some also shared that they were unable to access the limited benefits the current plans provide due to age or other factors. There are disproportionate impacts of limited or no fertility coverage on single and LGBTQ plus parents in particular, although fertility care needs are not exclusive to these communities. Fertility is a fundamental part of healthcare and should be accessible to everyone, regardless of age, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, or marital status. I appreciate the time that the Labor Management Benefit Committee members have dedicated to exploring options to help employees pursue various paths to parenting through assisted reproductive technology, adoption, or surrogacy. And Claire Adamsick on my staff has done amazing work working with you. Particularly thank you to Michelle and to Kathy, as well as to Ashley Grundy and the subcommittee members. This is really important work. Those of us who are parents know, as was mentioned, what a life-changing experience that is. And for those who wish to become parents, everybody should have access to benefits And it shouldn't matter whether you're on Kaiser or Moda to get that done. So thank you for being willing to continue to work on it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Colleagues, any further comments or questions related to this item? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll on item number 377 first.
Hardesty?
Incredible work to make sure that all employees have equitable benefit packages. We continue to work on it until we get it right. Thank you so much, Kathy Bless, and your staff for all the work you did to bring these reforms in front of us. I vote aye.
You Daly.
Well, I'm very happy to support this item. Carly, it was nice to hear your voice, and I wish you luck in that exciting endeavor. We celebrated the anniversary of marriage equality in Oregon yesterday, and I see this as another step in the right direction for equality and justice. And I'm happy to vote aye.
Fritz.
Colleagues, it makes me really happy to hear of your support because some of this work will continue after I leave office at the end of the year. And so thank you for being willing to continue to work with the amazing Kathy Bless and Michelle Taylor, who have done such great work with all of the Labor Management Benefits Committee. I attended some of them when I first started, and I was just so impressed at the work that the partners are doing to make sure that healthcare is provided. Another of the pieces that I'm really excited about this package is about the waiving the co-pays for mental health care, and that's for both the Kaiser and the Moda plans. Not only that, but for the Moda plan, co-pays for inpatient services and treatment for mental health care will be paid for. So in addition to the to what we're providing for the firefighters, the special needs that they have for health, for mental health care as well as physical care, it's really good to see the city taking the lead on mental health care and recognizing its importance, because we know that when employees are experiencing mental illnesses, that they need to be able to talk to professionals and to get the help that they need. And because of the health privacy rules, it's very difficult for supervisors to manage and support employees within the workplace. So again, thank you for your work on that. And I know that that is something that will need additional work as you continue to evolve. Thanks in particular to Claire Adamsick, who has been so helpful in making sure that I understood and that others understand the challenges and the needs that everybody has, everybody may have, regardless of your status. Aye.
Wheeler.
Well, first of all, thank you for a great presentation. These changes to the benefits plan extend access for city employees to critical health services, which are as important as ever when we're in the middle of a global pandemic. We know that the effects of the pandemic are causing a strain on mental health as well as obviously physical health. So I'm glad that we're able to provide some additional mental health benefits through our plan partners. There's a lot of people here, too many to name individually to thank. So I just want to collectively thank the Bureau of Human Resources staff and all of the members of Labor Management Benefits Committee for the incredible amount of work they put into amending the City of Portland Employee Benefits Program to improve our offerings for everyone. Commissioner Fritz, I want to personally acknowledge you and your team for the work around fertility benefits. That's some strong work, and it's so important to both being able to protect the health and the well-being of our employees. And as you indicated, this moves us towards our aspirational goals of being an employer of choice at every turn. We want to be able to recruit the best people, and we want to be able to retain the best people. And obviously, health benefits is one of the way we're able to do that. So thanks, everybody, for your great leadership. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Carla, could you please call the roll on the related but different ordinance 378?
Hardesty.
Aye.
You Daly?
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you, everyone. The next item is item number 381 on the regular agenda.
Declare intent to centralize, guide, and coordinate COVID-19 efforts that bolster progress towards the city's long-term recovery goals.
Colleagues, the resilience resolution is an important starting block as we continue providing immediate community relief and as we begin to map out longer-term actions to help Portland come out of this COVID crisis a stronger community. This resolution is not proposing a new set of city values. Rather, it is affirming and enshrining existing community-driven priorities as the values that will stay primary throughout our COVID-19 response work and our longer-term recovery. This resolution is also not, by itself, an action plan. Rather, it is a values framework that will form a key input to the decisions that we're going to make going forward. This resolution is possible because of our community partners' work to turn the values of climate action, environmental health, civil rights protections, and equity into city-adopted resolutions, ordinances, and specific plans. This resolution reaffirms the fruit of that hard work and the shared values our community has entrusted and expects us to uphold. This resolution also owes a debt of gratitude to my council colleagues and their staffs, former council members, and current and former city staff. This is truly a collaborative effort. Thank you to those who led the way on earlier actions with their vision and to those who helped shape today's action to reaffirm those important values. We have City Bureau directors and community leaders with us today to walk us through this resolution. And so with that, we will start with KeyBEM Director Mike Myers. Oh, I'm sorry, wait, before you jump in, Mike, a little bit of administrative detail here. Colleagues, I'd like to offer up the substitute resolution. Can I get a second?
Second.
Okay, and Commissioner Hardesty, will you also accept as part of the substitute the addition of Exhibit A?
I will.
Very good. And legal counsel, Lori, we're good with that?
It's fine, Mayor.
Very good. So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion on the substitute? Carla, can you call the roll so we can put the substitute on the table, please?
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The substitute and Exhibit A are now on the table. Director Myers, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor and Council, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Mike Myers, the Director of Portland Bureau of Emergency Management for the City of Portland. I have been in the emergency service business for over 30 years. I began my career when I was 19 years old as a firefighter in Las Vegas, Nevada. Over 26 years I spent there as a career and ended up as the fire chief. And in time, I would become your fire chief here in Portland. And now I'm here as your emergency manager. Over those years, I have fought many fires. I have managed many large disasters, and I have never witnessed anything like this. None of us have. The magnitude, the duration, the complexity. We activated the City of Portland's ECC, the Emergency Coordination Center, in early March to manage the city's response to COVID-19 outbreak. On any given day, you can walk into the ECC and there, a small group, 25 to 50 people, will be working diligently in a response to the pandemic. Almost every city bureau is represented there. Employees from all over the city spend endless hours working together, side by side, in our operations center. They're focusing on assuring that people are sheltered, people have food to eat, people have access to appropriate personal protective equipment and hygiene items. People have access to information. Teams of people from across the city have been working hard on unemployment assistance, rent and mortgage relief, and providing financial stimulus wherever we can. We have volunteers from the NETS, neighborhood emergency teams, working in the ECC and in the field. We are working closely with our other public partners, private business owners, and dozens of community-based organizations. The ECC is led by Katie Wolf, who is the operations manager of the ECC and has been your incident commander since the very beginning. She shares that command with a different city bureau director each week, and Katie has done an amazing job. We are also tightly linked with Multnomah County, where the public health department is located. John Up of FMU, our planning, policy, and community programs manager, is the deputy incident commander at the county and works closely with their public health team. And finally, I'd be remiss if I did not offer my deepest gratitude for the dedication and selfless efforts of our public safety teams, our firefighters, police officers, park rangers, our 911 operators, and certainly our doctors, nurses, food service providers and cleaning service providers, shelter operators, and all the supporting service providers working every day to help our community through this period. I have always said, at every emergency I've been to, it is always neighbor helping neighbor, and this is true today. Thank you, Portland, for being strong and dedicated to winning this battle. We still have a long way to go. We will get there, and we will get there together. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Director Myers. Next up, we have the Office of Equity and Human Rights Director, Dr. Markeisha Smith. Dr. Smith, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Mayor, Commissioners, I'm excited about this recovery resolution and honored that the Office of Equity and Human Rights is strategically positioned in the resolution to provide leadership and guidance in what will be a critical direction for equity across the city, both big and little C. And I'm grateful for our partnership with equity managers, in particular Irene Marion, as well as other practitioners and folks in the Office of Equity and Human Rights to really bring this to life. And I do have a few slides very quickly if I'm able to share the screen, if that's okay with everyone. Just to highlight a little bit of where we are. And hopefully everyone can see. Yes?
So, yeah, that's good. Okay, great.
The role of the Office of Equity and Human Rights in this resolution is to work in partnership with our bureaus and city staff to really live into our city's equity goals for our COVID-19 response. We are assuming authority to monitor what that implementation looks like. And we want to make sure that we're coming back to share updates and reports to city council, city staff, and our community members as we move forward in this work. We have developed an equity toolkit.
Excuse me for just a sec. This is like a lot of background noise.
And
I didn't want to ask if that was your kids.
It is.
Okay.
So I will, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
My mother is with him, but he's playing really hard. So,
I thought other people.
Here we go. We'll just do it outside.
I was going to ask other people to mute, but then with your crew.
Sorry about that.
Only during the time of COVID would this happen.
And the door is closed. I apologize. They are really, really having a good time.
It's all good.
As I was saying, the goals of our equity toolkit, which have been developed in partnership with our equity managers and our Office of Equity and Human Rights, really, I believe, reiterate the City of Portland values, commitments, what our legal obligations are as they relate to civil rights. And they also identify our populations that have an urgent need that will be most impacted over time. And, you know, when we think about those populations, it's not, I want to, you know, always emphasize that it's not because of the color of someone's skin that COVID is having an impact, but rather the systems that have failed to serve Black, Indigenous, and people of color in our system. And so just want to make that clarification. Some other goals of the toolkit is to make sure that we're encouraging our Emergency Coordination Center and bureaus to really adopt this toolkit as a part of their processes and to establish those expectations for what equity goals look like specific to our COVID-19 response and really beyond. So this is, we hope, a start to something that will continue our work in equity across the city and not just live in this moment in time, but we want to focus on this moment in time. And also to provide some access, easy access to tools and assistance that can help inform our policies, our priorities, our strategy in our decision-making going forward. And for the first time, we really have, I think, a great structure around accountability measures. And so we're asking that we have quarterly reports that include what we're calling an equity scorecard at this point, that would come from bureaus, come to the Office of Equity and Human Rights, and that we would be able to bring that to council. And that when we sort of get to the end of some of this at some point, that we also have an annual report that we're able to provide to council that really communicates what the collective progress has been as it relates to our citywide equity COVID-19 goals and response. And this final slide is just a little bit about some of the needs that were highlighted in the toolkit itself, and you can read more details about that. But as you can see, I don't think anything here is really surprising. These are, you know, the needs that have shown up from Community Voice as they've probably been coming to council. There are things that are showing up in our news media, not just in Portland, but across the country. And so we want to make sure that we're staying attentive to this, and that this list isn't exhaustive. So there are some things that are not even here that we haven't identified and named, but we wanted to make sure to specifically highlight these and also connect that to why we do need to have a collective response to what happens for equity in the time of COVID. And so I will stop sharing and I can pass the mic.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Dr. Smith. Next up is the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability's Director, Andrea Durbin. How are you today?
Good morning, doing well, Mayor. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrea.
I'm Andrea Durbin, Bureau Director for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We commend the City Council for seizing this moment to clearly articulate values and vision for how we intend to recover as a community from the crisis by centering racial equity and climate justice. This is a pivotal moment as we're facing converging crises, the COVID-19 pandemic, the resulting economic crisis, climate change, and systemic racial inequities. It is imperative that we rebuild our community and our economy in a way that improves public health, reduces disparities, especially racial disparities, and addresses the disproportionate impact of the climate crisis. Doing so requires us to be integrated and collaborative in our approach and not siloed or insular. Our ambition should not be to return to normal, but to build back better and more just. We must ensure shared prosperity, equitable distribution of resources, and a healthier community that is sustainable, resilient, and safe for all Portlanders. We can do that by committing to several principles. First, recovery must not lead us back to business as usual, which caused harm to many Portlanders. The track we were on before the pandemic was a planet in peril, resulting in disparate social, economic, and environmental impacts, inequities, and divergent access to wealth, opportunity, and health. Two, recovery efforts should help us reduce carbon emissions that cause climate and climate change and mitigate the health impacts, not add to the crisis while we improve community resilience. Three, recovery must address the racial disparities that have been laid bare by this crisis. Economic relief should be provided directly to the people most impacted by this crisis and who have been historically harmed, while also protecting against further displacement. Four, recovery efforts should help create family wage jobs. Climate action can accelerate economic recovery, create livable wage jobs, and enhance social equity. Recovery provides an opportunity to make a down payment on a regenerative, low-carbon economy while also helping to prevent future crises. And finally, recovery efforts must be undertaken with community. Our work at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is moving in that direction. Now is the time to co-create with our community partners to align our goals, priorities, and actions, and ensure city policies and investments center communities most impacted by this crisis. BPS has decades of experience coordinating and facilitating multi-bureau climate action efforts focused on both reducing carbon emissions as well as preparing for the coming impacts of climate change. We're well positioned to help bureaus leverage and build off each other's work by facilitating information sharing and network building across the city. For example, BPS can help bureaus leverage the Water Bureau's expertise in climate science and modeling, BES's expertise in climate resilience, Parks' expertise in energy efficiency, PBEM's expertise in community resilience, PBOT's expertise in behavior change, and PROSPER's expertise in clean tech. BPS is a connector, convener, and facilitator, and we will bring those skills to help build a collective effort that delivers real impact and strengthens our community. We're in the process of assembling materials, tools, and resources similar to those that have been developed by the Office of Equity and Human Rights to assist bureaus with applying a climate lens to their recovery efforts. And the City of Portland has a unique tool that other cities do not have in this recovery process, the community-driven, voter-adopted Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF. PCEF will be a source of investments to support disadvantaged and marginalized communities in the transition to a clean energy economy while creating jobs and building community resiliency. PCEF provides an opportunity for the city to address these converging crises and invest in a just clean energy transition while reducing the energy costs for low-income people and communities of color. We expect the City Council will distribute between $6 and $8 million by the end of this year through PCEF and closer to $40 million next year to accelerate Portland's clean energy transition. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability stands ready to support City Bureaus and City Council in working directly with our community partners to help Portland achieve these important goals and recover better. Finally, I'd like to thank all of you, Mayor and City Council, for your national and global leadership in taking such a clear stand in prioritizing and centering Portland's COVID-19 recovery work with our commitment to racial equity and climate change. Your action will have ripple effects across our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Durbin. Next up is our PBOT Director, Chris Warner. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. For the record, Chris Warner, Director of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. I'm honored to be here with my colleagues today to affirm our commitment to working together on COVID relief and recovery efforts. In the second week of the activation of the Emergency Coordination Center, I had the opportunity to serve as the incident commander. Since then, we've had a number of PBOT staff volunteering with the ECC teams, focused on outreach to community organizations, addressing urgent food and resource needs, managing projects, and leading the planning efforts. This experience has given our teams deep perspective on what matters most to Portlanders right now. What we are hearing and feeling in this moment is that the first priority in meeting these critical needs for populations in the front line in this public health pandemic. Portlanders really want us to facilitate a safe reopening to support the movement of people and goods in our transportation system, especially to critical destinations and local businesses. And third, Portlanders want us to work towards a more just and sustainable future, one that assures that we apply an equity-focused approach to our policy and resource priorities so that we truly improve the outcomes for generations to come. This really is a critical moment in our city's history and requires bold leadership to be activated in all areas of our work. We have the opportunity not just to respond to the COVID-19 crisis, but also to accelerate our ability to take climate action and create a healthier, more just, and sustainable future for our city. For several decades now, sustainability and climate action have been woven into everything we do at PBOT. When we improve access to transit, build a sidewalk, add a new street crossing, or stripe a bike lane, we aren't just making it safer and more convenient for Portlanders to get from place to place. We're also making it easier for them to shrink their carbon footprint and improve the air quality for everyone. Our equity commitments and transportation justice focus are newer, but also becoming part of the fabric of our organization. To align and amplify PBOT's commitments to climate justice and equity, our current strategic plan requires us to continually ask two critical questions. First, will our decisions advance racial equity and address structural racism? And second, will our decisions reduce carbon emissions? To echo these sentiments shared with our leadership, my director colleagues, and community representatives, this public health pandemic has revealed in stark and many times tragic detail the inequities in our society and also here in Portland. All of us have been affected by the COVID-19, but PBOT understands that Black, Indigenous, and people of color, immigrants and refugees, older people, people living with disabilities, and the unhoused populations are at the highest risk for the COVID-19 and feeling the disproportionate and compounded effects of this public health pandemic. As PBOT works with our sister bureaus to take climate action and shift in swift outcomes for frontline populations, we are committed to reducing vehicle miles traveled, using cleaner energy by accelerating our integration of electric and clean fuel vehicles into our system, planning and building complete neighborhoods where Portlanders can easily meet their needs while consuming less. And in each of these, we are committed to leading with equity and climate justice and ensuring that frontline communities are informed about our work. Our success in reaching these lofty goals depends on how we work day to day, street by street. That's how we are delivering with the voter-approved gas tax. We are investing where the need is greatest and exceeding our goals for minority contracting. We're so grateful that Portlanders renewed their trust in us by approving the Fixing Our Streets program last night in such overwhelming numbers. This will make it possible for people all over the city to go where they need to go and to do it safely. Before COVID-19, you saw us fulfilling these commitments through a number of programs, infrastructure projects, improving the speed and reliability of transit, the Roselane project, pedestrian and bicycle safety investments, including lighting infill, road redesign, and neighborhood greenways in East Portland, and also innovative programs such as the Affordable Housing Transportation Wallet, which reduces the financial barriers to a suite of transportation options for people in public housing and affordable housing. In this COVID reality, we are pivoting this work to be responsive to the needs of our new reality. In the last few weeks, you've heard us announce our Safe Streets Initiative, where we support safe reopening of our city and provide new options for Portland's transportation future. Our teams are preparing business toolkits, guidelines for distancing in public space and transit stops, and best practices for moving safely through our transportation system. In the coming weeks, you'll see more PBOT announcements inviting frontline communities to partner with us to address the immediate relief and long-term recovery efforts. We at PBOT will initially commit $100,000 to prioritize the engagement of networks supporting transit-dependent communities, essential workers, minority-owned businesses, and organizations providing care and distributing food resources to high-risk populations, especially Black, Indigenous, people of color, immigrant and refugees. PBOT Equity and Inclusion Program and the Transportation Justice Steering Committee will lead and hold us accountable for this work. We will center our equity commitment as we collaborate with BPS on the city's overall climate justice framework for COVID response, working not to just decrease the carbon emissions, but to simultaneously increase economic opportunity and improve health outcomes. We look forward to working with PBAM, BPS, OEHR, all the other bureaus in the city, and our many amazing community partners to take this challenging work ahead and to create a more just, healthier, and sustainable future. Thanks very much for your time, and thank you for your leadership.
Thank you, Director Werner, and again, congratulations on last night's absolute landslide. Good work. Next up is Andrea Valderrama, Coalition of Communities of Color. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Mayor, Commissioners, I really appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. Before I get started, I just wanted to say that I have that unstable Outer East Portland Wi-Fi. And so if I get a little delayed, I have a colleague who will help jump in and make sure you all have the remarks for you in written format. Like the mayor said, my name is Andrea Valderrama, and I currently serve as the advocacy director for the Coalition of Communities of Color. I am a registered lobbyist with the City of Portland speaking on behalf of the CCC. Existing racial disparities, socioeconomic factors, and inequities in health outcomes and in healthcare access means that our response to preventing and mitigating COVID-19 must prioritize communities who need it the most, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. BIPOC communities have been living in a tapestry of injustices for generations. Therefore, it is not true that the virus does not discriminate. We have seen it discriminate against our AAPI communities. We have seen it discriminate against our Black, Indigenous, and Pacific Islander communities. We have seen it discriminate against our Latinx communities and other communities of color. For these reasons, we must always lead with race. We must target recovery and resilience efforts on BIPOC community members in the following three ways. First, we need your partnership with Multnomah County to address both the public health and the economic impacts of this virus as you implement this resolution. I appreciate that it centers both of these areas through an environmental and climate lens. Two, use the City of Portland Equity Toolkit for COVID-19 when prioritizing additional budget and policy priorities. This toolkit is very well written, thoughtful, really appreciate all of the hard work that went into the development of it. I really do think that it lays a great framework for the work ahead. We
appreciate the adjusted accountability measures, support the inclusion of those accountability measures into the resolution itself. I think that that's an important part of what you all are doing today, and I appreciate that. The third and final one is meaningful community engagement. This does not mean engaging BIPOC-led organizations at the last minute and after mainstream white-led organizations, as has been the case in the past. There must be a true meaningful partnership with culturally specific CBOs, again, with BIPOC-led communities who are working on this work and who are partnering with you in the work ahead. While we were slightly disappointed to see a resolution about us, without us, and our input, we do appreciate the substitution that was put into the record today, Mayor, and does incorporate our proposed amendments. So thank you for that. Some additional COVID budget and policy areas our communities have raised include rent and mortgage forgiveness, resources for improving substandard housing, access to PPE, subsidies for business owners and undocumented individuals, coordination and tracking of hate crimes, resources for culturally specific CBOs, bridging the digital divide, and the collection and reporting of data that is disaggregated by race and ethnicity. We cannot be complicit in going back to normal. Things were never normal for our communities to begin with. If we are intentional about creating a more just and equitable community, we must call out systemic inequities and work towards weaving a new, stronger tapestry of systems and institutions that work for all communities. I very much look forward to working with you all on these efforts, and thank you for your leadership and for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Andrea, for your
testimony. I think you might be on mute, Mayor.
Oh. Can you hear me now?
You're good.
Good. All right, thank you. Next up, we have Anissa Pemberton from the Portland Clean Energy Fund. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for welcoming us back again. My name is Anissa Pemberton. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm the Portland Clean Energy Fund Coalition Coordinator. I want to extend my gratitude to the Office of Equity and Human Rights for putting together such an awesome toolkit for our community to use. I also want to comment that it's lovely to see everyone's personal choices of interior design, to see so much beautiful art on everyone's walls is really interesting. I want to comment that I think this is an important opportunity to rebuild the city of Portland as a model of equity and justice through a well-planned economic recovery. Just as our just transition work, we have a choice between a recovery from COVID-19 that replicates or exacerbates existing inequities, or recovery that centers BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, and eliminates injustice. I think it's important that we center racial justice and equity in a collaborative efforts between Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and Pacific Islander communities and the city. The PSF Coalition expects that the city will invest significantly in community-based nonprofit infrastructure. The nonprofit infrastructure sector, as you all know, employs 14% of the Portland's working class. And it's important that we invest, particularly in frontline community-based nonprofits. This is an investment in the fundamental health and well-being of our vulnerable communities, our most vulnerable communities. We need significant investment in community development corporations, healthcare providers, social service providers, and we all know that these are intersecting needs, that this is an ecosystem of the nonprofit structure, and that it ultimately will be an investment in the economy and the well-being of our most vulnerable. Our invaluable frontline community-based organizations are facing existential threats, not just of climate change now, not just of economic injustice that already existed, but now of a new current health and environmental crisis at an unprecedented scale. Latinx people are 2 times as likely to catch COVID-19, Pacific Islanders are 4 times as likely, and BIPOC communities as a whole are almost 2 times as likely. And I believe this is because we make up the essential workforce. Finally, we need to invest in the climate goals that uplift workers and build towards a just transition. I'm very encouraged to see this as a focus of the COVID-19 recovery. The Portland Clean Energy Fund, of course, it offers a great pool of resources for green jobs and renewable job projects, but
more needs to be done for additional green jobs to equitably transition to 100% renewable economy. I really appreciate all of your time today. I'm happy to pass it off to my other colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Anise. Appreciate it very much. Next is Taryn Evans, the Environmental Justice Manager for the Coalition of Communities of Color. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners. My name is Taryn Evans, and I serve as Environmental Justice Director at the Coalition of Communities of Color, and I'm here today representing the PSF Coalition. Right now, we are living through unprecedented times and dealing with one of the worst public health crises in generations. Yet this isn't just a public health crisis. The effects of COVID-19 are wide-ranging and have been exacerbated by the economic and environmental state of crisis that we were already in. COVID-19 provides a stark example of the disparities experienced by Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. Lack of access to healthcare and living wage jobs, increased exposure to air pollutants have had the compounding effect of making our communities more vulnerable during this pandemic. BIPOC communities are at greater risk of developing serious complications from the novel coronavirus. Environmental injustices are among many other factors that contribute to this disparity. Communities of color are often concentrated in areas with a lack of green space and tree canopy coverage and in closer proximity to industrial areas and heavy traffic, resulting in poorer air quality, higher rates of asthma, and other respiratory illness. COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting communities of color, and if we don't center race in this recovery, then disparities will only continue to widen. Culturally specific, community-based organizations who have been doing the hard work to eliminate these disparities need support and investment now more than ever if we hope to have a just recovery. The Portland Clean Energy Fund provides an example of the types of programs that we need to get us toward that just recovery. The fund will provide apprenticeships and green job training and is grounded in racial justice. Right now, when we face staggering unemployment numbers, this is essential. We are at a pivotal moment right now, and how we respond is critical. These deep systemic inequities have been magnified by this pandemic. We need to take bold action and work toward creating a society more sustainable, resilient, and equitable than the one that we had before this pandemic. And I'd like to end with a quote by Michelle Romero, who is the Executive Director of Green for All. So we shouldn't settle for going back to normal. Not when normal means kids continue to breathe polluted air and drink unsafe water. Not when people who work hard keeping our economy going cannot achieve the basic dignities of healthcare or good pay. We shouldn't go back when there is the opportunity of going forward and realizing energy independence, healthier communities, cost savings, and job creation. This is the opportunity to dream bigger and do better. Thank you.
Thank you, Taryn. We appreciate it. Next up is Jenny Lee from Apano. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Jenny Lee, and I currently serve as the Advocacy Director for Apano, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. I'm a registered lobbyist with the city speaking on behalf of Apano. First, thank you to our colleagues who've spoken to many of our collective concerns, issues, priorities, and recommendations. So I'll take this opportunity to speak to some of the specific impacts on Asian and Pacific Islander communities and how these need to be incorporated into all of the city's responses. Explicitly articulating community-specific impacts of the pandemic is needed so that we can implement meaningful interventions and solutions that actually result in equitable outcomes. We at Apano have been engaging on a range of strategies to respond to COVID-19, including some key partnerships with the city, which we greatly appreciate, and working on direct relief, small business support, community outreach, responding to hate incidents, and developing policy solutions. In directly addressing the public health threat, we must begin by addressing the disproportionate impact of coronavirus on Pacific Islanders. This is no surprise. Like other disproportionately impacted communities, the underlying health and economic disparities dramatically increase the threat presented by the pandemic, both in terms of contracting the virus as well as the severity of it. Speaking to some of the specific experiences of Asian Americans and Asian immigrants, we have seen significant mental health impacts and trauma as a result of increasing bias and xenophobia, incidences of bias and xenophobia. fear of this racial discrimination is actually keeping community members from going out, including to access critical resources such as food banks. We're hearing that community members are actually avoiding traveling at all because of even when they are facing food insecurity, because the threat has become so severe. This compounds the strain that we are all experiencing as a result of the pandemic, and we are concerned again to see the increasing frequency and severity, and we hope that the city will continue to reiterate that message in its responses of ending this discrimination. While many of our communities prioritize staying at home early in the pandemic, well before the stay-at-home order, they also face increased health risks. For example, living in multi-generational housing, experiencing a job loss that's resulting in households doubling up, and also their employment as essential workers. A particular note, thinking ahead to how we will respond to the housing crisis and providing assistance and addressing evictions will be critical, and I hope that this is a focus consistently from the city. An equitable recovery must effectively serve our small businesses and workers, including those owned by Asian and Pacific Islander communities. We'll need ongoing strategies expressed in this resolution to ensure coordination and support with an emphasis in the small business arena in terms of addressing the specific earliest and hardest hit businesses as well as workers. The city's contribution to the Oregon Worker Relief Fund is an example of an innovative, justice-rooted, and community-driven strategy. We hope to see ongoing support and also express our gratitude for our early opportunity to collaborate with Prosper. In addition to the recommendations shared by my colleagues, we also want to lift up strong tracking of the strategies that we're using and the impacts, being sure that along the way we are collecting community-driven, accurate data and anticipate ongoing community engagement and analysis of the outcomes, so we have guidance and are able to evolve and improve our responses as we deal with the immediate threat as well as the recovery. This resolution is an important reiteration of how the city must practice the equity principles that it has laid out. And under the strain of the pandemic, we must absolutely maintain these commitments and not perpetuate or commit the traditional response where our communities are hit first and worst and then are neglected in our strategies to rebuild. Let's use this resolution as a reminder to do better. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and the opportunity to work together for a more equitable Portland through a meaningful partnership.
Thank you, Jenny. We appreciate it. Thanks for your great testimony. Next up is Oriana Manyara from Verde. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Oriana Manyara. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the Climate and Energy Policy Coordinator at Verde. Verde builds environmental wealth for communities through organizing, advocacy, and social enterprise. We are testifying in favor of item 381 as it lifts up the converging climate and COVID crises and is intended to center Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color in the trajectory of the city's response. We are all realizing how crucial connectivity is and how much we have taken its ease for granted. We can no longer be in community, organize in person, and many people are isolated, even more so if they lack access to the broadband and technological connectivity that enables us all to be present in this space, in this moment. We take this ease for granted. Verde's community has been hit hard by the COVID crisis, not only in connectivity to people and devices, but in connectivity to resources like food, personal protective equipment, and money to pay rent and utilities. But these are not new crises, nor are the revelations that communities most impacted by COVID are also the communities most impacted by air pollution. This dual burden proves catastrophic. It is not new that evictions or the disruption of community connectivity through gentrification and displacement are unjust, that it is unjust that people are energy burdened and threatened with disconnections of utility service. We have done small things to smooth the sharp relief of these problems exacerbated by a public health and economic crisis. But the question we must ask is, will this change be lasting? Will we remake a system that has been historically oppressed Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities? The answer is we must. Verde sees much language in Council Item 381 that outlines good intentionality towards equity and acknowledges present climate and historical economic impacts on Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color. But we would note that the city often acknowledges these things, and that is not enough. Concerted, committed, and community-led action is the only way to carry out the change that we need. We applaud the naming of the community-based energy goals in the 100% Renewables Resolution, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, and the Zero Cities Project as examples of what this can look like. And we need more of this, especially around the digital divide, which increasingly impacts access to the environmental benefits that will build wealth for communities through PSEP and mitigate the air pollution that harms Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities that they face disproportionately. Verde is committed to this work, and we see collaborative and co-creative models like the one forwarded through the Zero Cities Project as the path toward a just recovery. But we disagree with the language that names that there is a tension between maintaining employee positions and benefits and providing direct resources to community organizations and community members who are directly impacted by COVID-19. This is not an either or. The city must invest in and maintain the positions of employees with lived experience who are skilled in working with communities. It must expand the resources of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, which needs more staff capacity and resources to administer Title VI and provide interpretation services, which are essential in this moment. And now is lifted up to administer the equity toolkit that has been named and lauded today. It must also enhance the ability of bureaus to capacitate communities to come to the table and let community need drive programs and policies. We are all realizing how crucial connectivity is, and that means that both links in the chain must be strong, community to lead and government to facilitate the resources to carry out that vision. Verde sees much language in Council Item 381 that outlines good intentionality towards equity. But we must ask the question of whether we are willing to settle for equity or fight for justice. This may only be answered after council passes this item. You must ask yourself if your vote is symbolic and merely acknowledges the language of the whereases, or if you are dedicating the city to the values therein. If it is the latter, and we urge that, then we ask that you as council members and the bureau directors listening today to commit to and follow through on a community-led process to develop subsequent legislation that establishes action and resource allocation in direct response to community need. You are strengthening the chain with this resolution, but now we must see if it will hold the weight. Thank you. Verde looks forward to your partnership.
Thank you, Ariane. Appreciate your testimony. Next up is Bob Salinger from the Audubon Society. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. You're good to go.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and members of City Council. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. We want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and we also appreciate the work that went into this resolution, the opportunity to collaborate on it, and the opportunity to collaborate going forward. I want to support and applaud the comments that have already been made by my colleagues today. It is incredibly important that we work together to create a more equitable and just and healthy landscape. We were already in crisis before the COVID-19 crisis hit us. What it has shown us is how far behind we were to begin with. And as you've already heard today, business as usual is not good enough. That cannot be our goal. If we achieve business as usual, return to what is normal, then we have failed. And we need to keep that in mind as we think about how we allocate resources. Business as usual would not suffice. We appreciate the call out of nonprofits in this resolution. Nonprofits are often on the front lines of providing essential community support, and they've been hit very hard by COVID-19. They often do not have the kinds of reserves or safety nets that are found more generally in the business community. It's an irony that the organizations most committed to building our community and protecting our community often don't have the resources themselves to maintain themselves under these kinds of circumstances. We'd urge you to look broadly at what that really means. Some of those benefits are hidden. I'll give you one example from our organization. We've maintained the operations of our wildlife care center throughout this crisis. We did that because there's no other facility in the region that treats wildlife. And there's a humane reason to keep it open, but there's also a public health reason as well. Those 3,000 wild animals that come to us every year, if they don't come to us, they go into people's homes. And if they go into people's homes, there are real risks. We shouldn't forget the fact that COVID-19 most likely began because of inappropriate interactions between wildlife and people. And that's why we've kept our facility open, even at the peak of the crisis. We also appreciate the specific call out of environmental goals along with equity and climate change. Green infrastructure, natural resources, natural systems, landscape resiliency. We particularly call your attention to the Portland Watershed Management Plan, which is now 15 years old, but which called for the city to evaluate environmental health in every project it does. We're not there yet, but we need to get there now. COVID-19 has driven home in a visceral way, in a frightening way, the way a healthy landscape or an unhealthy landscape leads increased risk of this kind of disease. Let me put it another way. If you live in a place that is tree deficient, you're going to have lower air quality. If you have lower air quality, you're going to have a higher risk of asthma and other respiratory diseases. And if you have a higher risk of asthma and respiratory diseases, you're going to have a higher risk of contracting COVID-19 and dying from it. And we know that these issues play out on economic and racial lines, that it is disproportionate how they play out. It's absolutely critical that we ingest the environmental health of our landscape. And too often when we talk about climate change, we focus on the emission end of the spectrum. That's critically important, but so too is building a healthy landscape. Well, I'm really happy that we're having this conversation today. I want to point out that we need to move up beyond words on a page. We're really good at doing resolutions in this city, but there are things happening right now where we're missing critical opportunities. In fact, some of the worst projects are accelerating while we're in the COVID-19 crisis. We need to make sure that we're putting the brakes on bad projects and rethinking things in a different way, even as we struggle to deal with this. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. We need to keep moving forward on the tree code. Right now, my neighborhood is fighting to preserve, we're an under-treed neighborhood. The largest tree in our neighborhood is likely coming down, in part because the city gave a cut order on that tree. Our tree code is absolutely insufficient today, and we need a much stronger tree code. We need to move forward on the light pollution efforts. We need to move forward on floodplain protections. These are projects that are already underway. My fear is that they're going to slow down. This is a time to accelerate, not to hit the brakes. There are big projects that we seriously need to rethink. I think about Levee Ready Columbia and the I-5 Rose Quarter Freeway expansion. Projects that are $1 billion in public funding that have accelerated during the COVID-19 crisis, but which absolutely fail to meet our environmental, our climate, and our equity goals. We need to do things differently. We're still being way too timid and way too complacent about business as usual. We have an opportunity to really rethink our landscape, rethink how we allocate resources, and come out of this, as you've already heard, better, healthier, and more just. So thank you for your work on this. We look forward to working with you going forward.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your testimony and your work on this. Next up is Dr. Pat O'Hearn, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome.
Thanks. Good morning. Good
morning.
For the record, my name's Patrick O'Hearn. I'm a practicing acute care general surgeon, and I'm the board president of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Guided by the values and expertise of medical science, our over 2,000 members statewide address the gravest threats to human health and survival, including war, militarism, climate change, and environmental degradation. We support the resolution before you today, declaring the intent of the City of Portland's approach to COVID response and recovery with a focus on climate and equity. The COVID-19 pandemic has shown a light on the inequalities and disparities in health experienced by so many Portland communities. The disproportionate impact that the virus is having on Black, Indigenous, and other people of color in the city of Portland and beyond is disturbing. We are right to be taking action to ameliorate those impacts, which include but are not limited to a high infection rate in Latinx, Pacific Islander, Black, and Indigenous communities. We support the calls of our colleagues from frontline-led organizations who've already spoken today. In my work as a surgeon, initially there was somewhat of a lull at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in my work as elective and non-emergency operations were canceled and people avoided coming to the emergency room. However, pretty quickly we started seeing things pick up as people still suffered from diseases like appendicitis, cancer, and serious infections that aren't COVID. Likewise, the problems that we face here, like racial injustice, poverty, houselessness, wealth inequality, and climate disruption, have not gone away. So I was encouraged to read the resolution and see that the city is committed to addressing foundational concerns as part of its response to COVID.
The pandemic in many ways is showing us what needs to be done to address the many overlapping health crises we face. Both climate change and racism are public health issues, and we know that rising xenophobia and hate against Asian American communities and their businesses was one of the first things that we saw with the current pandemic. Disproportionate rates of infection and higher impact on communities breathing high levels of air pollution should come as no surprise. Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities have been speaking up about the ways that environmental racism harms their health for generations, and the structures of capitalism force many into essential work that is vastly undervalued and puts them at a high risk of exposure to COVID. These are longstanding disparities that also lead to disparities in the ways that climate impacts human health. We appreciate that this resolution sets a strong tone for the values and goals that should remain central for the city of Portland as it addresses these issues and applies federal stimulus money to efforts to weather the ongoing storm we currently face in unequal ways. Now is the time to double down on our commitments to equity and sustainability in our collective work towards a just transition, both to weather this current crisis and to be more resilient for future challenges. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dr. O'Haron. We appreciate your being here with us today and your testimony. Next up is Nick Caleb, Center for Sustainable Economy. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners, and thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. My name is Nicholas Caleb, and I'm the staff attorney at the Center for Sustainable Economy, an ecological economics think and do tank based in Portland. In order to respond to the COVID crisis and the background socioeconomic and racial inequities that it has drawn into even clearer view, we must understand and name broader systemic causes and use public resources and planning to create a more just, life-affirming, and resilient city. The COVID crisis has laid bare how fragile capitalism is as a system of provisioning basic goods. The capitalist mode of production is good at generating surpluses for the sake of the wealthy few, but poor at maintaining just and resilient systems of provisioning that keep most people housed, healthy, and whole. COVID infection in humans likely emerged as a consequence of industrial incursion into nature, and transmission rates were exacerbated by a fast-paced global exchange network. The anemic and stressed response to the crisis was a result of just-in-time production models applied to critical economic sectors and decades of disinvestment in both government and the care economy, which consists of child care, early childhood education, disability and long-term care, elder care, health care, and other essential labor, whether paid or unpaid, that ensures the health and well-being of our society. Thus far, the COVID relief effort has disproportionately benefited the already rich and politically connected. Locally, organizations like the Portland Business Alliance have lobbied for more expansive definitions of essential workers and for companies to be able to opt out of the Portland Clean Energy Fund tax that was enacted overwhelmingly by Portland's voters. PBA would put workers at greater risk and deprive communities of resources during the crisis for the sake of protecting the profits of large corporations already receiving significant federal relief. In contrast to this vision, Portland should reject the logic of austerity and corporate protectionism, raise additional revenue from taxes on wealthy and large corporations, and provision all available resources to a just and sustainable future. Within this context, we seek specific actions from the City of Portland for the COVID relief effort and beyond. First, CSE stands with our frontline and nonprofit community partners in advocating for provision of COVID relief funds to support their important work. Second, we believe the present crisis must be a wake-up call and used as an opportunity to expand the care economy and access to essential services like healthcare, public transportation, and good food as the foundation of a local Green New Deal. This labor is low carbon and provides immense value to everyone in society. The public sector must explicitly and directly invest in care activities that the market considers to be valueless. Otherwise, community needs will continue to go unmet and vulnerable people will continue to suffer. Third, we need to use this moment to prepare for the ongoing crisis of climate change and the disaster of a Cascadia 9.0 earthquake. These crises should be addressed simultaneously by investing in community-scale renewables, weatherization, and worker skills training. We need to take seriously the immense risk posed to the Willamette River and communities from seismic vulnerabilities at the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub and Portland Harbor Superfund site. With the fossil fuel economy in freefall, we should plan for a managed decline of fossil fuel infrastructure in our city as well. The city should support a just transition, one that protects workers, communities, and the river, and is in line with carbon emissions reductions targets. This pandemic has shown that resilience on a scale that we need can only be addressed through clear and concerted efforts to value human life over corporate profits. We have suggested amendments to the resolution in line with these principles and have emailed this language to the city clerk for council consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. We appreciate it very much. And last but certainly not least is Nicole Johnson from the Thousand Friends of Oregon. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and City Council. My name is Nicole Johnson, and I am the Community Engagement Manager for 1000 Friends of Oregon, a nonprofit that advocates on behalf of Oregon's land use planning program. We work with Oregonians to enhance quality of life by building livable urban and rural communities, protecting family farms and forests, and conserving natural areas. Right now, we have experienced a dramatic shift in the way we work, live, travel, and communicate due to COVID-19. Some people have been able to maintain their lives as normal, but many are dealing with the fallout of the pandemic. The resilience resolution comes at a time where the city can recommit and bring to the forefront its goals and aspirations. In this time, we're centering the most vulnerable populations is the most important, in particular, commitments to racial equity and climate resilience. Thank you for your continued work serving our city during these uncertain times. We support the City Council moving on objectives and policies that focus on our climate and racial equity goals that have already been vetted by Portlanders and community partners. The effects of COVID-19 have exposed inequities in our society, including land use decisions, inadequate and unaffordable housing options, transit access, and disproportionate exposure to climate change. We understand that during emergency response, city plans could be left to the wayside due to what might be deemed as an urgent matter, but the results would not produce the best outcomes for all communities affected. This is why the city must uphold its commitments and policies previously made before COVID-19. Our communities are depending on it. In addition, we applaud the city's decision to fund the Anti-Displacement Portland Coalition and recognize that the coalition is critical to the recovery of Portland's BIPOC communities. We know without anti-displacement policies and investments, this pandemic and economic shutdown will disproportionately harm Portland's most vulnerable communities. We hope to see the city continue to resource the coalition in the future. We are glad to see the city continue to act in good faith in keeping its commitment to equity and climate resilience, utilizing plans and policies that center anti-displacement strategies and policies, climate action, environmental health, and upcoming zone changes that could result in more affordable and diverse housing options. We look forward to being a community partner in recovery efforts. Thank you.
Nicole, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. So colleagues, that finishes our invited testimony for today. I know each of you will have some comments you'd like to make, but let's see first if there's any public testimony. Carla, do we have people signed up for public testimony on this resolution?
Yes, Mayor, we have one person, Ellen Mickle.
All right, welcome, Ellen. 3 minutes, please, name for the record.
That's a mistake. I'm just an attendee today.
Okay, no worries.
Thank you
for participating and listening in. We really appreciate it. So I want to thank everybody for their testimony, their leadership, and their strong ongoing commitment to help our family members, our friends, and our neighbors during this state of emergency. Colleagues, at this point, before we take the vote, I'd like to open the floor for any thoughts or questions you have. Commissioner Hardesty, you have your hand raised.
Thank you, Mayor. It was actually on purpose, too.
And you're unmuted. It's like the perfect.
I want to thank all the invited testimony today. Clearly, a lot of thought has been put into this resolution. This resolution is really about what we rebuild coming out of this pandemic. And as many of you have said today, I personally have no interest in rebuilding systems that were inequitable to begin with. I also want to say that as every government in Oregon and across the country, as all of us are facing severe budget challenges it was important for this city council to actually know we will have $75 million less going into next year's budget. How do we prioritize knowing that there are the needs in our community are just overwhelming at this time? And what we are hearing all across the board clearly is that there are a lot of people that are desperate, that want the city to step in and save them, their business, their nonprofit, their community. I am proud that this city council really was very thoughtful of thinking about who are the people first hit, worst hit, and hardest to recover. Who are the people that today still don't have access to COVID-19 testing? Who today still are concerned about collecting the virus? It's primarily frontline communities, it's people in service industries. And so this resolution is really about the city council actually drawing a line in the sand to say that as we start recovering, and by the way, we have not one penny yet for recovery, but as we start recovering in the city of Portland, it is important that we lead with our values. And so I support this resolution. I also understand that a lot of asks that people have, it will be simply impossible for the city to personally do. But what I know is that we can be strong advocates at the state and federal level, at the county level, as we have been throughout this pandemic. And so what I hope is that all the people that showed up today to testify, that you don't go anywhere, because the city cannot do this alone. We need the community. We need our federal partners, our state partners. This pandemic exposed what communities of color have been saying for generations, which is we live in an inequitable community. The resources are not shared equitably, and the outcomes are not equitably enjoyed. Communities of color knew this before the pandemic. I think there are a lot more people that understand that is so. And I'm proud of the work that we've done here at the city of Portland, both through Prosper Portland's Economic Recovery Task Force. That's been a really thoughtful way to hear from so many community members about what they're experiencing right now. But I also know that there are a lot more folks whose voices have not been included in that process. And we need to continue to find ways to include more voices so that when we are making decisions, those decisions are intentional and they are absolutely through an equity lens. I want to really compliment Dr. Marquisa Smith and her staff for the excellent job that they did in creating the equity toolkit. I'm always the biggest whiner about equity tools because normally they're like open to interpretation. And I think her team did an excellent job of having some real outcomes that we can hold ourselves accountable to. And let me just say that yes, because we are putting more work on the Office of Equity and Human Rights, many of us support making sure they have the resources necessary to do the hard job that they have moving forward. And so later today, we will be dealing with the city's budget, and that certainly will be a key part of how we both invest now and as we invest moving forward. And so I just want to say that this has been a labor of love, and it's also a labor of anxiety, right? Because none of us know today what the resources we will have as a community will be 6 months from now, right? We're doing our best guess right now. And I'm proud that tomorrow we will have a work session to talk about how we start investing those limited resources we receive from the federal government, the $114 million CARES package. But again, the reality is that's all we know about at the moment. Nothing else has been promised. So we only can work with what we have in hand. And so thank you all. I look forward to the hard work ahead. But I have to say, I'm actually excited. I'm very excited about what we rebuild together, because what we had, we know nobody, we're not going back to that. And I'm really, really excited. And crisis becomes opportunities. And in this crisis, to be able to center frontline communities and BIPOC communities and be really intentional means that we're going to have much better outcomes at the other side. So thank you all. And I look forward to the hard work that we all have ahead of us.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Anybody else before I call the roll? Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
I said all the fabulous things I want to say. Thank you all. It's great to see you all. I am an enthusiastic yes. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Udaly.
Great. This public health and economic crisis has only highlighted the urgency of integrating equity and climate justice in all of our work. We also have to prioritize supporting the capacity needed for this work to happen, which is something that we've struggled with. This resolution chronicles the deep inequities of our past, and it provides direction toward a more equitable future. I want to thank everyone who provided testimony and acknowledge your many valid concerns and recommendations. The good news is that the Equity Toolkit is a living document, and we can provide further input for development. So while we're not making further amendments today, it's not a static document. I'm obviously very supportive of this resolution, proud to co-sponsor it. I want to especially thank Irene Marion, who is the Portland Bureau of Transportation's equity manager, who is the person who actually developed the equity toolkit during her time on the ECC team. Sam, Tia, and Amanda at the mayor's office, who have pulled together a resolution that encompasses our city's pivotal plans and community-supported vision. Thank you as well. Thank you to Dr. Markeisha Smith, OEHR staff, and the equity practitioners who will be providing guidance and accountability for implementation. I finally want to express my support for giving OEHR some teeth. I've never really understood why that wasn't done from the outset. And I am looking forward to their guidance moving forward. So you have my full support. Please reach out to my team anytime we can be of assistance. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Crises systematically and disproportionately impact marginalized communities, and the COVID-19 pandemic highlights that fact, as we've heard today. We urgently need aligned collaborative strategies that promote transformative policies and equitable outcomes. This resolution reaffirms our citywide racial equity values and grants the Office of Equity and Human Rights Authority to work with Bureau partners in a coordinated, equity-centered response to the crisis that prioritizes Black, Indigenous, people of color, people with disabilities, and other historically oppressed communities. And we heard from many of those communities today. We didn't hear from anybody from the communities experiencing disability. There is a reason that the Office of Equity and Human Rights was founded with a focus on race and also a second intentionality towards assisting people with disabilities. The Office of Equity and Bureau of Human Resources staff are working to ensure accessibility in the actions of the emergency response. And we must recognize that people experiencing disabilities are also disparately affected by COVID and disadvantaged in recovery. You just think about healthcare needs, caregiver needs, transportation needs, all of those, in all of those ways, people experiencing disabilities have particular challenges and particular expertise that we can all learn from. I appreciate my colleagues signaling their support to adequately fund the Office of Equity so that it can continue to lead this important work. And it's very important to acknowledge that behind this resolution, real tangible work is already underway at the Bureau level that can help support implementation of the goals outlined in this policy. Eric Pachenko, Equity Manager of the Water Bureau, has developed an equity center analysis and associated checklist to help the Water Bureau and its customers they serve lift out this pandemic. And Eric, thank you for your work on the Equity Toolkit and working with Irene Marion. Additionally, the Water Bureau is working with Astrid Dragoy in my office to develop utility assistance for small businesses with an equity lens to help most vulnerable customers. And I thank Kathy Cook and the Customer Service Center for the outstanding work that they've been doing during this crisis in reassuring people that their water is safe to drink and that they will be able to defer paying their bills if they need to. It's human nature that in times of crisis, we can get pushed in the direction of doing things the way we should, we've always done them. I'm proud to say that has not been the case with the city's response to the myriad negative effects of COVID-19. When we can affirm that we are all part of the same social and civic fabric, we are stronger as a city when all of Portland's communities are whole. I'm very grateful to Mayor Wheeler and his staff for leading this collaborative effort, working closely with my team and with each of the council offices, as well as our bureau and community partners, to create a framework that guides our long-term response efforts. Thanks specifically to Sam Diaz, Tia Williams, Amanda Watson, Nicole Grant, and Mustafa Washington in the mayor's office. I will have to say that one of the things I like most about, well, I like many things about the substitute ordinance, but I liked especially that it is designated as having been prepared by Claire Adamsick, Derek Bradley, Andres Oswell, Amanda Watson, and Tia Williams. And thanks to Sam Diaz for giving the credit to other staff and also for being the coordinator of that work. Thank you to Dr. Markeisha Smith and Irene Marion for your leadership in bringing together the Equity Toolkit, and as I mentioned, the other equity managers for giving input to it. The toolkit represents an important collaboration between the Office of Equity and Bureau-based equity managers, and it's crucial that as a council, we support the success of that ongoing partnership. I thank each of my colleagues for being willing to sign on to their own accountability and responsiveness to the Office of Equity. That's what it takes to truly move the equity work forward, is when each commissioner is holding their directors accountable for reaching the goals and policies that are indicated in the policy and in the toolkit. Thank you to the staff at the Office of Equity who supported the development of the toolkit, this resolution, and other key response guidance. Kofi Desu, Danielle Brooks, Tatiana Elhaldi, Jeff Selby, Nicole Sharon, Jonathan Simeone, and CJ Robbins. Thank you to Director Mike Myers, all of the directors there, Mike Myers, Andrea Durbin, Chris Warner, for your leadership in centering equity and climate action in both immediate and long-term resiliency planning, and particularly my directors, Mike Sturer and Dr. Markeisha Smith, as well as the whole team that they work with. And my whole team played a role in helping bring together this work, and that's Claire Adamsick, Astrid Dragoy, Yesenia Carrillo, Tim Crail, and Misan Kwan. And it's astonishing that all of this has come together so quickly and so well. Thanks to all of our community partners who gave input and the work that we will do together. Aye.
Wheeler.
Thank you. And I want to acknowledge that this resolution, like so much of what we've done since the COVID-19 crisis began, was developed very, very quickly. I want to particularly thank my colleagues for working overtime with my office to make this happen. And in particular, I want to acknowledge the collaborative efforts of our various council staffs, particularly Claire Adamsick, Derek Bradley, Andres Oswald, Jamie Dumahill, Hannah Holloway, and Astrid Dragoy. Thank you very much for your leadership on this. I also want to thank the many bureau directors and the staff who reviewed and improved this resolution's language and who will do the important work to keep us on track with these values in mind. And I'd like to thank my staff, Sonia Szymanski, Amanda Watson, Tia Williams, and Sam Diaz for shepherding this work. I'm very happy with the leadership that this council has shown throughout this crisis, and I'm equally proud of the Bureau leadership citywide. We have never been more coordinated or less siloed during my tenure, and it shows. We moved quickly at the local level and provided immediate relief through our Emergency Coordination Center, the Economic Recovery Task Force, from our city bureaus, and from critical efforts my council colleagues have led like immediate housing and utility relief measures. These actions provide yet another demonstration of the Council's priorities during this crisis. Through today's resolution, we will ensure the guiding values of climate action, environmental health, civil rights protections, and equity are elevated in our ongoing work. Just a quick note about each. A sound respect for the best available science demands that we reaffirm our climate action, clean energy, and environmental protection goals and mandates. If we are able to fulfill these goals, we'll be a more resilient Portland, a city with more jobs, cleaner air and water, and a healthier society, not just for now, but for generations to come. To further guide this focus area, an improved climate emergency declaration reflective of the brilliance of organizations and community members on the front lines will be coming before City Council next month. That declaration will update the city's 2030 and 2050 emissions reduction targets and center Portland's approach to climate action on the frontline communities by creating a shared vision of climate justice and jointly developing actions for the city and community to undertake together across the climate crisis. We've heard loudly and clearly from those on the front lines, nothing about us without us. This is a concept I'm committed to institutionalizing in city practices. Reported discrimination cases, COVID-19's disproportionate impacts on certain members of our community over others, and a growing number of working people who can no longer make ends meet, while a few have seen their profits dramatically increase, demands that the city reaffirm its civil rights and equity goals and mandates. I'm committed to centering the voices of community partners in accordance with this resolution's direction. We cannot rely on traditional status quo, top-down processes and solutions. We must work together to create and leverage new opportunities, to rebuild trust in government, and to realize its potential, and always be mindful of the greater good. I look forward to working with my colleagues to breaking down silos, not just within city government, but by also creating partnerships that center community members and organizations who've come together to make this resolution a reality. Together, and only together, can we create a more just, more secure, and more resilient Portland. This resolution is just a starting block as we continue to grapple with this crisis. The work continues. Please join the City Council virtually on Tuesday, May 26 at 9:30 a.m. to listen to my colleagues discuss the city's priorities for our CARES Act funds in a council work session. With that, I say thank you all. I vote aye. The resolution is adopted. Thank you. And I've lost my agenda. Where did it go? Here it is, right in front of my face. Thank you, everybody. Carla, can you read items 384, 385, 386, and 387 together, please?
Yes. Item 384, approve application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for 146 West Building 100, located at 11 146th Avenue. 385, approve application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for 146 West Building 200, located at 21 Northeast 146th Avenue. 386, approve application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for DECA Multifamily, located at 330 Northeast Deakum Street. 387, approve application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for Harboski Annex LLC, located at 1245 North Anchor Way.
All right, thank you very much. And Dory Van Bockel is here. Dory, I don't know if we need a lengthy presentation on this. This is somewhat boilerplate per council policy, but if you have some opening remarks, we'd certainly like to hear them.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Hello, Commissioners. My name is Dori Van Bockel. I'm with the Portland Housing Bureau, and we have four inclusionary housing multiple unit limited tax exemption applications for with ordinances for approval before you today. So just with some quick background, starting in February of 2017, any building adding more than 20 new units is required to contribute to the city's affordable housing inventory through the inclusionary housing program. Projects have several options to fulfill the inclusionary housing requirements. It's either including affordable units in the otherwise market rate buildings, sending units to another building, or paying into the inclusionary housing fund. The percentage of units depends on affordability level and whether a project is within the Central City or Gateway Plan District or outside of those plan district areas. And the multiple unit limited tax exemption or multi-program is one of the financial incentives provided to inclusionary housing projects choosing to make units affordable rather than paying a fee in lieu. And so each application does come before council for approval. We do have a brief presentation that I'll share just as a means to walk through those projects real quickly. It closed on me. All right, are you all seeing this then?
Yeah, we can see it.
Yes, yes.
Perfect, okay. So moving on then. The four projects, as mentioned in the introductions, there's two in outer northeast, one in inner northeast, as well as one in far north Portland. The first one, the 146 West Building 100, is a three-story residential-only building consisting of one-bedroom units, roughly 430 square feet each. This project is actually making all of the units affordable at 60% of median family income and will restrict all of those units under the inclusionary housing program for 99 years and therefore is eligible to have all of those 24 units receive the benefit of the tax exemption over the 10-year period. As far as the benefit to the project specifically, the tax benefit on average over the 99 years is about $28, or the building as a whole is $668 per year over 99 years. But looking at it annually, there's a $6,600 benefit roughly compared to a rent discount of about $4,400. And then as far as on the 146 West Building 200, it similarly is part of the same project and is also making all of the 22 units in the three-story building affordable. Those are all one-bedroom units, about 460 square feet, and will likewise be making all of them affordable over 99 years, and has also per annual tax benefit then of about $572 over 99 years. And there's a difference in the benefit for 10 years of $5,600 compared to about $4,400 of a discounted rent. The Deacon project is a 39-unit, four-story building consisting of studios and one bedrooms, averaging 336 square feet and 409 square feet
relative there, and is making most of the units affordable. It will have 34 of them affordable at 60% of median family income, and is also voluntarily making more units affordable in order to have the tax exemption on more units. Outside of the Central City and Gateway Plan districts, they otherwise would only receive the tax exemption over that 10-year period for the units that are affordable. This also avails them to additional exemptions through the System Development Charge Exemption Program, as well as the Affordable Housing Construction Excise Tax. And looking at the DECM specifics, that one has a per year total of $2,815. And over the 10-year, there's a difference of $27,000 for the whole project compared to a rough difference in the average rent of $3,000. And the last project is Harbor Sky in North Portland. It's a 5-story building with 113 units. There's a unit mix of studios, 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom units. And this will be providing the minimum affordability required by the program under the option at 80% of median family income, and will result in 2 studio, 11 1-bedroom, and 4 2-bedroom units restricted over that 99-year period. On a per unit basis for the affordable units then, that results in roughly a per year amount of about $24,000, as well as then a $4,500 rent discount on average. So that does conclude the quick presentation. Are there any questions about these particular projects?
Colleagues, any questions? I'm not seeing any hands raised. It looks like you did a thorough job there, Dory. As always, we appreciate it. Carla, is there any public testimony on any of these four items?
No one registered, Mayor.
Very good. Could you please call the roll on 384?
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Dory, thank you for being at the beginning of our agenda and close to the end, and for your succinct presentation. Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. 385, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. 386, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Last but not least, 387. Please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Please read item number 388.
Amend fee schedule for tree permits.
Portland has been known as a green and livable city, and Portlanders are justifiably proud of our urban tree canopy, which includes trees on both public and private land. Trees provide countless benefits to people, as we heard in earlier testimony today, climate and wildlife. They produce oxygen, clean the air and water, provide shade and reduce the urban heat island effect, reduce soil erosion and runoff, provide habitat, increase property values, and more. Portland Park and Recreation's Urban Forestry Division is proud to support our urban tree canopy, but they rely on fees in order to provide essential services to Portlanders. The Urban Forestry Department reviews its fees annually. This year's proposed update is a moderate fee increase for development permits, meaning permits needed when a building or a new home or significant remodel of a home takes place. The proposed fee schedule does not change any fees for non-development situations like a permit to remove or replant a tree on your property that's become hazardous. We have Brian Landau from He is the urban forestry analyst. He's on the line to answer any questions that anybody may have. Colleagues, any questions? Brian, it's good to see you. Thank you for being present today. Carla, is there any public testimony on this item?
No one registered.
Please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz. Oh, I'm sorry, Mayor. This is a non-emergency.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Well, Carla, not yours.
On a roll here.
let me do this. That was a good practice vote, people. That was really good. Brian, since you're here, I just want to thank you for the hard work you put into this. I know it's not easy, and we all appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to also add my appreciation, and I think it's a credit to the good work that Brian did that no one signed up to testify. Normally, when we're talking about trees, we have a lot of public testimony. And so that just says to me that you did excellent work in preparing to bring this to us. So I thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Very good. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Last but not least, item number 389, second reading.
Authorize $548,094 total in grant funds for the 2020 Cannabis Social Equity Grant Program in the Office of Community and Civic Life.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. We've already heard a presentation on this item and an opportunity for public commentary. Is there any other business on this particular item? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
So I want to take a moment to appreciate the hard work of the Oversight Committee that put these grant applications together. And I want to appreciate Commissioner Udaly and actually leading this effort over the last 3 years to make sure that we were using cannabis tax dollars to actually invest in making community members whole. We will continue to talk about cannabis tax and whether or not we are investing them in ways that give us the outcomes that we're looking for. But I am proud to vote yes today to support the work of this committee. I vote aye.
You Daly?
Well, I want to thank the team at Civic Life, Michael, Christina, and in particular, Kimier, who's shown impressive leadership during the COVID-19 crisis and facilitating this grant selection and notification process and getting these funds to our community partners as quickly as possible. At the beginning of this crisis, I asked Civic Life to fast track this effort and to ensure that set aside dollars would get to struggling communities and organizations as quickly as possible. And I'm really pleased that we're able to accomplish this together. Even in a crisis, we have a responsibility to invest in communities that have been the most harmed by our historic and racist public policies, such as cannabis prohibition. There are 4 buckets of spending for cannabis dollars: public safety, recovery and treatment, economic development, and restorative justice. In my mind, restorative justice is the most important bucket to fund with these dollars. We did harm to Black and Brown communities with our drug cannabis prohibition laws. And as we talked about earlier, acknowledging that harm is not enough. We have to deliver a remedy. We have to make tangible differences in people's lives who have been disproportionately and adversely affected by these laws. Portland has become a national leader for cannabis social equity and restorative justice, despite the fact that funding has been inadequate for the last 3 years. So I'm going to continue to fight for funding and to ensure that we fulfill the ballot measure goals of restorative justice for BIPOC communities. So today I'm excited to approve these projects which will provide legal services, educational and organizing opportunities, and wraparound supports for Portlanders disproportionately impacted by these past policies. I want to thank the grant committee for their work as well, and I vote aye.
Fritz.
Well, thank you and congratulations to all of the community organizations who are going to be the grant recipients. You're doing very important work in the community. Thank you, Commissioner Udaly and your staff, Jamie Duhamel, Hannah Holloway, and former staff Winter Johannes, for your continued advocacy to retain a portion of cannabis tax revenues for direct community support. Kimmy Ye Uoka in the Office of Community and Civic Life has done amazing work on this. My representative on the grant committee, Jessica Rojas, who works at the Northeast Coalition for Neighborhoods, but participated on this committee in her personal volunteer time. Thank you to you, Jessica, and to all the other community members who gave their time and energy to this process. And thanks to Claire Adamsick and Tim Crail, who helped set up the program initially with the guidance of the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team, and who have remained really invested in it. It's certainly something that I will continue to watch and feel happy about, that we have community benefits. We have a range of programs in the three different areas that were identified in the ballot measure that passed so handily. And I wish you well with making good choices on how to spend it in the years to come. Aye.
Wheeler.
Ditto everything my colleagues just said. This is fantastic. These resources are going to get out into the community, and we're going to make a significant impact. So thanks to everybody who worked on this. This is a very easy thing for me to vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you. And we are adjourned for at least the next hour. We'll see you all on the other side.